So, thank you very much, Tony, and thank you for inviting me. I found it a little odd that Tony insisted that I talk about the relationships, distant relationships among human languages, but...
Not quarks, not complexity.
That's right. But I am involved in some work on that in a way that I'll describe in a moment, so it's not completely inappropriate. And the fact that I know a few words of some modern languages here and there is not relevant to this, really. I succeeded in getting some funding for a project which is for which the headquarters is the Santa Fe Institute, where I work, which I helped to start. I was, for 23 years, one of the directors of the J.D. and C.T. MacArthur Foundation, based in Chicago. And when seven other directors and I were finally declared overage, in my case, after 23 years, the term limits really took a while catching up with me. They told each of us that as a sort of booby prize, each of us would be able to make proposals amounting to $1 million, which would most likely be approved, if they made any sense, if the other directors and their expert advisors thought they made sense. And I devoted 4/5 of my $1 million to setting up this project at the Santa Fe Institute to study distant relationships among human languages. Distant, of course, in time as well. When you look at larger taxa, you're also looking deeper into time. And I'll explain later why it's necessary to get special funding for this kind of work. It's not, in many circles, it's not popular. Now, most of you know at least some words of various languages, and you know that the languages are related. And probably most of you know that the relationships have both a, what you might call a vertical and a horizontal component, as in biology. In biology, you have vertical descent, characteristics inherited through the germplasm of ancestors, and others which are acquired by chance during the lifetime or of the organism or some preceding stage, like the embryonic stage with human beings, but also horizontal jumps, like jumping genes, which can simply be transferred from one organism to sometimes a very distantly related organism by a kind of horizontal transfer, which is not the same as inheriting genes from the parents. Many people in biology who work on very early evolution and try to construct the very early parts of the tree of life allege now that probably in the very early days of life, the horizontal transfer was even much more important than the vertical. It's very interesting to see these trees of life because they're all these little tiny organisms with huge numbers of branchings and so on and so on. And then way out here, there's one tiny little branch that includes corn and rabbits and people and so on and so forth. One little tiny strand at the end. The so-called animal and vegetable kingdoms are way out there on this little twig. Anyway, that's important. The relative, it's important to think about this and whether in language there's something similar. To think about horizontal, vertical transfers and chance. So when we look at the relationships among languages, we might look for various things. We might look for lexical items, that is words, parts of words, you know, prefixes, suffixes, and so on and so on, called morphemes, usually. Or you can look at grammatical rules of various kinds. And you could look at the sounds. Mostly, people have found that what's conservative and likely to be transmitted vertically is lexical items, but lexical items with sound changes. But the sound changes are usually rather regular. And when you look at particular languages, the way in which the sounds are transformed is fairly regular from one word to another, even though the professional historical linguists spend a lot of their time studying and writing papers about what seem to be exceptions. So it's not quite so rigorous and beautiful and simple as they claim. but it is nevertheless roughly true. Grammatical rules tend not to be among the most conservative things transmitted vertically, but I believe, and some of my colleagues believe, that a few of them are very conservative and could be used as well, along with lexical items, for tracing vertical relationships and constructing a tree of languages, a Stammbaum, analogous somewhat to the tree of life. But mostly one uses lexical items. Here at the top part of this transparency, you can see some words in Latin and the Romance, a few Romance languages. Can you see that?
Is it?
It's not exactly in focus. Is there something can be done to improve the, this little thing here?
Yes.
What do we do with it?
I turn.
Twist it?
Yeah.
I'm not strong enough.
Oh, David.
Oh, you turn it this way. I see. Yeah, that's a lot better. No, many of you can't see it. Is that right? That's too bad. It's only going to get worse. All right. Well, I'll read them. Man, Latin hominem, we use the accusative. It's usually the accusative in Latin that gives rise to the Romance words. And you see it becomes uomo in Italian. For some reason, it's written H-O-M-O here. It should be U-O-M-O in Italian, uomo. Mm-hmm. Spanish, hombre. Portuguese, homem with a nasal O. You didn't let me say it.
But that's one of the languages I know.
You just told me today you were very bad in Portuguese.
No, I am very bad.
You already had your say, Tony. And French, you see father, patrem in the accusative in Latin, then padre in Italian, padre in Spanish, padre in Portuguese, père in French, and so on and so forth. Down here, you can see how these illustrate some regular sound changes that take place in Romance. So, Latin initial P is an initial P in Italian, in Spanish, and in French. That's a pretty simple rule. P between vowels, however, can become a B in Spanish and a V in French, as you see from some of these examples. Latin initial B is an initial B in Italian, in Spanish, and in French. Latin initial intermediate B between vowels is a V in Italian, a B in Spanish, and in Spanish B and V are pronounced very much alike, and although differently at the beginning of a word and in the middle, but very, very much alike to each other. In French V, and so on and so forth. This is an example of what are called sound laws. The sound laws are not usually, aren't quite so simple. They're usually various ifs and thens and so on that you have to add on to this. As I said, the historical linguists keep investigating little tiny changes and exceptions and so on. But roughly speaking, there are regular sound laws. Now, you can go from this branch called Romance to the family of which it is one branch, one of about 10 branches. And that's called, as you know, Indo-European. It's usually traced back to a speech that Sir William Jones made to the Asiatic Society in Calcutta in the 1780s. When he pointed out the similarity of Sanskrit, Latin, Greek, the Celtic languages, and so on, and suggested that there was a common remote ancestor, fairly close to Sanskrit, but ancestral also to Sanskrit. Since then, they've added other branches, including our own, Germanic, which includes English. And every person who studied historical linguistics admits and enjoys the former existence of Indo-European, the present existence of a family of spoken and attested languages. Attested means not necessarily spoken anymore, but we have some written evidence or anthropological stories or something that allow us to know at least some of the words of a language no longer spoken. So here are the 12 branches of Indo-European, showing where they are geographically. The extinct Tocharian is out here in the desert of China, western China. The others are more or less contiguous here. You see the Germanic languages in Scandinavia, Germany, and England, and Holland also. You see the Slavic languages out here. You see the Italic languages, including all the Romance languages descended from Latin, in through here. The Anatolian languages, which are all ancient and extinct, spoken here in Anatolia, and so on and so forth. Also, of course, the Indic languages in India and the Iranian languages, mostly in Iran, but also elsewhere. There was even an Iranian tribe that invaded Western Europe along with the Germanic invaders when the Roman Empire in the West decayed. These were the Alans. And they left their name, Alan, which probably some of you bear. They went to Brittany. There was the Romans stationed them as foederati in Brittany. And a lot of Bretons were called Alan. And then when the Norman conquest came, there were a lot of Bretons among the invaders. And they carried the name Alan to England and then thence to Scotland and so on and so on. But they were an Iranian tribe. The Ossetians in the Caucasus, neighbors of the Chechen, are also Iranian speaking. And the Kurds as well. Anyway, all these branches can be related to one another. You see here that in Europe there are four non-Indo-European languages. Hungarian, Estonian, and Finnish, which are all related, and Basque, which is in a different category. We'll discuss the category later. So here are some comparisons of numerals in representatives of the different branches. Here's English, Gothic, an extinct language, an East Germanic language. All the East Germanic languages are dead now. But we have the Bible of Ulfilas, little wolf. An apostle evangelist among the Goths at the end of the 4th century who published text of part of the Bible, part of the New Testament in Gothic. So we have that. Here's Latin, Greek, Sanskrit, and Chinese, which is not a well-known branch of Indo-European. But the man who prepared this slide, who was Chinese, put in some Chinese numerals without the tones to show you that the words are different from what they are in Indo-European. So you see two, for example. Gothic, tri, Latin, duo, Greek, ancient Greek, duo, modern Greek, vio, Sanskrit, dva, Chinese, which is, you know, not very similar. You'd require quite a sound law to go to that. Five, quinque, the qu changes to a p here. You get pende in Greek, pende in modern Greek. Pancha in Sanskrit, as in rum punch, which comes from the five ingredients, punch.
And Punjab.
Punjab, they say. Punjab means five rivers. The ab is the same word as in the Avon, in the Welsh Avon, as in the English River Avon, where Shakespeare grew up. here we have seven, which is a very interesting word. Sivun in Gothic, septem, as you know, in Latin. Hepta is in Greek. The Latin S, initial S, is always an initial H in Greek. Well, likewise in Welsh, by the way. Sanskrit, sapta. Chinese, of course, is completely different. Nine, ten, all these numerals are in common, even though there are some peculiar sound changes. In four, the initial consonant has three or four different forms, but that's one of those exceptions that the linguists love discussing in their papers. But it's clear that they're all related. And we can see some sound laws here also. For example, two and ten show that initial D in Latin and Greek and Sanskrit has progressed to a T in English and Gothic. It's a Germanic change. In German, it becomes a Ts in modern German. So you get zwei, zwei, and so on, where you have a T in both English and Gothic. That's called the second West Germanic sound shift. T in Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit becomes Th in English and also in Gothic. This is another example. A certain kind of K, the so-called palatalized K, Q, in the original language, gives K's here, but an S in Sanskrit and also in Russian and the Slavic Baltic languages and so on. There's a, yes?
Can I interrupt? Is there any meaning to the fact that it's capitalized in golfing? And when did the concept of capitalization?
I don't know what the man who drew this slide up meant by capitalizing the T.
In many languages, there's no such concept as capital letters.
Yeah, this is a writing convention that has nothing to do with our concerns. And I don't know why this person put the capital T there. I have no idea.
By Gothic, you mean Visigothic?
Both Visigothic and Ostrogothic, both of them. They spoke essentially the same language. And you know that Gothic was spoken until the 16th century in the Crimea. So it's not that ancient, actually. It was spoken just a few hundred years ago.
Can I ask you something else?
Yes.
How come Alani moved from Iran to the Roman Empire?
Well, there were, you know, the the Goths were off in what's now Russia for quite a while. They were sort of taken over by the Huns. The Huns formed a kind of forced alliance with some of the Goths.
The Huns came from northern China.
Yes, they came across from northern China. Yes, that's correct. From just north of China.
Right.
And in fact, it may have been Chinese strength that had something to do with their moving toward the west, although there are many theories. So the Alans were dragged along with this alliance into Europe. They started not very far from Iran. In fact, you know, before the Slavs were there, there were Iranian tribes in Russia. The Scythians, who lived in much of what we call Russia, were an Iranian tribe too. Anyhow, this palatalized K becomes an S in Sanskrit, also in Slavic and Baltic, and so on. The K becomes an H in Germanic. So we have kentum for 100 in Latin, hund in Germanic, as in English, hund red. Red means to count. In Russian, sto is the K becoming a certain kind of K becoming an S. And so forth and so on. Six and seven have the initial S always, except in Greek you have an initial H, and in Welsh also you have an initial H, and in Iranian you have also an initial H. So these are all examples of sound laws in the whole of Indo-European. And the linguists love these things, and they cherish them, and they boast about them, and they exaggerate how regular they are, and so on and so on.
So you call it sound law. Is this for all words or just for the numbers?
All words.
All words.
Basically all words. All words that are inherited. There are also borrowed words, and there are also accidental resemblances, which we don't want to have if possible. Borrowed words are like the jumping genes in biology. They are horizontal transfers. Borrowing is a peculiar name because they're rarely given back. But then a lot of borrowers don't give things back. I'm sure the library here has that experience. Sometimes a word is given back. I know one example. There's a French overgarment called redingote, which comes from English riding coat. But it's very different from a riding coat. And the English speakers, liking the French fashion, imported the French word redingote into English. So we got it back. But that's extremely rare. Anyway, this word borrow is used for horizontal transfer. Like a word goes from one language to another. So in English, we have vast numbers of French borrowings, even though we have a Germanic language, basically, and lots of Latin borrowings and lots of Greek borrowings. Sometimes the French and the Norman French and the Latin borrowing give you doubles, like royal and regal. Royal coming through the French, regal coming directly from the Latin, and so on and so on. But these are all borrowings.
But that may not be borrowing, it's military imposition in some cases.
That's called borrowing.
That's awesome.
It's called borrowing. So, we have looked at two kinds of taxa then, a branch and a family. The various 12 branches, and then the family, the Indo-European family. For any valid taxon, it looks as if there was a proto-language from which they're descended, the way the Romance languages are descended from Latin. And it had a homeland. It was spoken somewhere, although it might have been over an extended area. And there might have been dialects. But at some time in the past, there were a bunch of people living in a restricted part of the world who spoke the ancestral language, the so-called proto-language.
But where did that language come from?
From, well, we believe it came from the same process earlier. And so on.
It was a single universal language.
Well, please don't jump the gun.
Okay, sorry. Apologize.
I want to be much more refined than to announce prematurely results and so on, or conjectures like that. That's not what I came to do. I want, anybody can do that. By associating with these learned and brilliant linguists, I've learned quite a bit of sophistication that I'm trying to convey. Okay?
I really apologize.
All right, good. But the general idea is we believe that the same process occurred beforehand and so on, and that the Stammbaum idea is not a dumb idea, that it can be extended backward in time. We think it's not like biology, where in the ancient times the horizontal transfers predominated so much over the vertical ones that you can't do the Stammbaum anymore, which is what, as I said, some people believe about the early history of life on Earth. We don't believe that's true of languages. We think you can do the same thing over and over again, putting the proto-languages into families and those families into families and so on, okay? It's not a dumb idea. It may be wrong, but it's not a stupid idea. So here's the other point. Proto-Indo-European is reconstructed then using the daughter languages. And the historical linguists are extremely proud of this. Mm-hmm. Of course, they all quarrel about what the proto-language was like. Shh, don't tell anybody that. They get into bitter arguments about the details of the proto-language. But to the outside world, like economists, they present a solid front. They're right, everybody else is wrong, even though they don't agree on what's right.
But surely it's not a unique solution.
Each person claims, if talking to anybody who's talking to you, an outsider, or to me, an outsider, would say, of course, we know exactly the proto-language, European, even though, spend all afternoon arguing with a colleague about what the proto-language was like. He would still say, of course we know the proto-language. And in fact, all the scholars of Indo-European do have a sort of rough agreement about the proto-language. Although they may look at different stages of it. That is, the proto-language with stars on the words means they've reconstructed them. And sometimes they look at double stars, meaning they've reconstructed an older form. Pardon?
Are there accepted criteria by which you would judge whether you have the right proto-language or not?
Well, yes. They use the habits of people in transforming one sound into another. For example, P goes readily into F. For example, in English, as compared to Indo-European, you generally have an F instead of a P, right? Patir, the original Indo-European word for father, becomes father in English, the P going into an F. So that's easy. F going into P is much rarer, very much rarer. For a consonant to be glottalized, and then for the glottalized consonant to disappear by one process or another, is not uncommon. For example, in the language near Santa Fe, Tewa, there's a lot of t. For example, mountain is ping, ping, with a glottal stop just after the initial consonant. Well, that kind of thing has a tendency to weaken, not usually to come in. It has a tendency to go out. So there's a lot of irreversibility in sound change. F may become an H. So P can turn into H. The H can then be dropped altogether. And the whole Celtic branch of Indo-European has that behavior that the initial P's were wiped out altogether. And so on and so forth. So that's one way. That's one way that they, one thing they use. In other words, the likelihood that this bunch of sounds in the daughter languages could have come from a certain ancestor is fairly narrowly focused.
So these methods could be tested on Latin and then...
They could be tested on other cases where you have the attested ancient languages, yes. Yes. But there are not many such cases. There are just a few around the world where you have the ancient language, ancient ancestor. Usually you're dealing with languages that are recorded from speech in modern times. So, the next family over is Uralic. which includes Finnish, Estonian, Lapish, Hungarian, everybody knows that, and then a lot of languages spoken along the Volga, Mordvin, Komi, Mari, and so on. Some of you may know the physicist Nikolai Nikolaevich Nikolaev. He is a Mari, for example. You can sometimes identify people who belong to tribes along the Volga, because when they speak Russian, they have a tendency to make all the vowels, all the O's in a word, O, like the accented one. So instead of saying Molako, like a Russian, they say Moloko. That's a typical Volga accent, and so on. But anyway, these are called Ugro-Finnish, all these languages. Hungarian belongs in the Ugric branch. These things belong in the Fennic branch. This is a Lapish branch, and so on and so on. Also, the Samoyed languages are included in Uralic. So there are two big groups of Samoyed languages, the Fenno-Ugric and the Samoyed. Samoyed, as you know, means self-eating. Hence cannibal. Very often that word is used by neighbors to describe a people. Either that, or they use some other pejorative word about what the people eat, you know, like frogs and so on. Eskimo is that kind of a word. It's an Algonquian word meaning raw he eats. And the Mo in Eskimo is the same as the Mo in Mohawk, which or Mohegan or something, which means he eats them. And it could refer to a cannibal, a wolf, or a bear, and so on and so forth. So, neighbors give all these names to their friends. Now, the final thing is that linguists, they differ a lot on the validity of this, but let's say as a rough rule, it is not bad. On the details, there's a lot of controversy. But they can estimate crudely the separation time between languages or among languages. The time since there was a proto-language and a united people. Now we have lots of examples from the last few hundred years of peoples that have split into parts. For example, in East Africa, in Kenya, you have the Agikuyu and the Akamba today, who are neighbors. Not so very fond of each other, perhaps. But they speak almost the same language. Kikuyu and Kikamba are very similar. And we can reconstruct from their stories and so on that just a few hundred years ago they were one people. And they split. Then the languages split, and they are growing further apart as time goes on. The same is true of the Baolé in Côte d'Ivoire and the Ashanti in Ghana. They also were one people some hundreds of years ago. They split, and a lot of differences. You know, the Ashanti have their gold weights and their Secretary General of the United Nations and all these things, and the Baolé have their beautiful ancestral statues and so on and so on. Nice musical instruments which the Ashanti don't have, and so forth. But a few hundred years ago, they were one people. So you can try to estimate what the separation time is, and there are various degrees of sophistication in this, but the most trivial form of this says you take a basic vocabulary list. I'll tell you in a moment what that is. You stick fairly closely to the meanings. That is, you don't allow a huge amount of semantic drift, which you may in other context, but not this context. So if there's a word for ashes, you want it to mean ashes, not garbage or something. And you look down the list of these fundamental meanings, conservative meanings that are likely to be kept through a vertical transfer, and you see how many are the same and how many are different. And then there's a rule that every millennium there's a certain percentage of wrong matches. So that, say, 14% per millennium is lost in common basic vocabulary, something of that kind. That was the original form of this glottochronology in its simplest, the simplest form, as proposed by Swadesh some decades ago. Let's just think of it that way. Later on, we can look at the sophisticated criticisms of this and how to improve it and all that. But everybody agrees, most linguists agree, that there is something to this. It's not complete nonsense, but that it's crude. So by this criterion, Indo-European comes out something like 6,000 years old, But actually, there are two ways of doing Indo-European, because it looks as if the Anatolian branch, including Hittite, Luwian, and so on, separated a little earlier than the others. And therefore, you can look at Indo-European with Anatolian and Indo-European without Anatolian. Mm-hmm. And maybe those depths are a little different. With Anatolian, maybe it's more like 6,500 years or 6,700 years or something. And without Anatolian, it might be 6,000 years, and with Anatolian, maybe 6,500, something of that kind. Uralic is of about of the same age. And there are many others of around the same age. Now, what is this list of fundamental meanings that are supposed to be very conservative, so that for vertical descent, you can use them as criteria of a relationship? Well, the sun, S-U-N, is an example. S-O-N isn't too bad either, but they would use S-U-N. Water, tooth, the numeral two, bone, blood, ashes, a whole lot of different things. It can be parts of the body, as you see. They can be things that occur around the household, things in nature, numerals, astronomical things, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a list of 35, that's the smallest one that anybody uses, a list of 35 very conservative meanings. There's a list of 100 very conservative meanings, which leaves out 10 of the 35, so it's really 110. And then there's a list of 200 very conservative meanings, and so on. The thing that's most often used is the 100 list. And when people go around New Guinea, for example, collecting dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of languages, you know, in every little valley, in every little fold, there's a different language. They don't have time to collect, usually, a huge amount of stuff, but usually they get the 100 words. So we have 100 word lists for a vast number of languages for which we don't have much else. Now that's quite bad. We should have much better information. And today there's a horrible death rate of languages in many parts of the world, including the United States. And so it's very important to gather this information rapidly. Some of us would also like to encourage the various indigenous peoples to go on speaking their languages. But of course, that's a very complex social issue. But the main thing for linguists is at least to collect the language before it disappears. So anyway, this rough, crude rule that you can keep in mind is that maybe two languages, once separated, accumulate differences in the 100-word list with semantic conservatism, right? You don't allow the words to change a lot. You keep pretty much to the initial meaning. Then something like 14% per millennium. So 0.86 for one millennium, 0.7 for two, and so on and so on. Actually, the guy that is in charge of our project, the Russian, very brilliant Russian, Starostin, uses a much more complex formula than this. But maybe we'll have time to mention that later. Anyway, I want you to have this crude idea of glottochronology, or what some people call lexicostatistics. Auld Lang Syne. Sign is the same as our word since. Old, long since. So, now we go to proposed superfamilies. And here we lose most of the historical linguistics community. They don't believe in any of this. They think it's crank. They think we're all crazy. I'll get to that later. But I just want to warn you that I'm going to talk about that later. But it isn't crazy. Absolutely not. So, here's a proposed superfamily proposed by this late Joe Greenberg. Joe Greenberg was a wonderful linguist, very much honored for his work on word order and other regularities in grammar, grammatical universals, all sorts of other things, for classifying all the African languages, which he did back in the 40s and early 50s. And also for trying to classify into rough superfamilies all the languages of the world. He did it in a very, I don't know how to describe it, a very rough manner. No pretense at rigor, no starred forms, no reconstructions, no sound laws written down. He did the sound laws all in his head. But he just did look by inspection at word lists, all the word lists of all the languages of the world that are known. And in this way, he classified things. And I believe that he got most of it correct, nearly correct or nearly correct. But that's what some of us believe. But his methods certainly could be improved on and be brought closer to the methods of the traditional historical linguists without causing any problem. It's just a lot of work. And that's part of what we're trying to do in our project. But I'll get to that later. In the meantime, a brilliant Yugoslav immigrant to Russia, or maybe child of Yugoslav immigrants, I don't know, called Ilyich Svitich, who was killed very early on in by a bus or something, he proposed something quite similar called nostratic, from languages close to ours, the Latin word nostrum, ours. And these two are very similar. I'll tell you what the differences are, and the differences differ a little bit from one linguist to another. But basically, this is the same similar proposed superfamilies. It includes Indo-European as one of its components. It includes Uralic as one of its components, and here is the whole thing on a map. So there's Indo-European, which we talked about over here, this stripy one. There's Uralic, this dotted one. Then there's Altaic, which is Mongolic, Turkic, and Tungusic. Tungusic includes Manchu, Gold, Evenki, and so on. Then the Chukchi Kamchatkan, which is up here, that's Chukchi or Chukotsky in Russian, or Luo-Ravitlansky in their own language, but with the Russian ski added. Luo-Ravitlan means not a demon, so that's their word for a person. A person is somebody who is not a demon. Luo Ravitlan, not a Ravitlan. So anyway, that's Chukchi. The neighbors are called Karyak and Kamchadal. And those three languages are spoken up here on the Kolyma Peninsula opposite Alaska. Then over on the American side, and also a little bit on the Siberian side, you have the Eskimo, or Inuit, and the Aleut in the Aleutian archipelago. And Korean and Japanese are now included in Ainu. not in Ainu. Korean and Japanese are now included in Altaic, along with Turkic, Mongolic, and Tungusic, by many scholars. There are some extremely conservative scholars who don't want to admit the existence of Altaic, even composed of Turkic, Mongolic, and Tungusic. Those people are really something else. And these are brilliant scholars and extremely learned, but just conservative to the point of exasperation. Yes. No, I mentioned Ainu by mistake. I don't want to say a word about Ainu. I don't want to. Ainu it is.
Ainu is.
I don't want to say a word about Ainu yet. Maybe later I'll mention it. But it's
now 12,000 years ago.
This is, yes, something like 12,000 years ago. Correct. Maybe 10, something like that. That's right.
The Proto-Bulgarian, which group?
Proto-Bulgarian, it depends what you mean. There are two languages that you could be thinking of. The original Bulgur people were Turkic speaking.
Right.
And the word Hur is a Turkic word for tribe. So the Bulgur spoke Turkish. They conquered Bulgaria, which got its name that way. But then they learned a Slavic language related to Old Church Slavonic. And that developed into modern Bulgarian. So around the 9th century, they switched from being a Turkic-speaking people to being a Slavic-speaking people. South Slav, like the people in Yugoslavia.
There are very few Proto-Bulgarian words left.
That's correct. That Turkic language that they spoke a long time ago, hasn't left many traces. But we know it was Turkic.
Mm-hmm. Is there an identified homeland with this group?
Ah, well, even for Indo-European, it's been very controversial, the homeland, because every scholar wants the homeland to be in his country, if he's a European or an Asiatic. Well, we're getting to that. We are consulting geneticists, archaeologists, tooth experts, anything you mentioned. We're consulting and we're trying to construct a unified picture of early modern human migrations that will include all this stuff. I'm getting to it gradually. I assume you guys have time. I don't know. If you want to end here, I will have to babble a few words and sit down. But this takes a little time to develop.
One of the things that bothers me is if you had the map, the Indo-European map.
Yes.
already spread out.
Yes.
So...
Well, with Indo-European, we know quite a bit about history, right? We have written records, we have all kinds of things to describe the migrations of people in the last few thousand years. So the controversy over the Indo-European homeland is a little less data-free than it is for some of the other language families.
I guess what I'm wondering about is, at this time this was, those homelands,
yeah,
6,000 year ago stage,
yeah. That's this. This is the 6,000 years.
Right.
This
right.
is the 10 or 12.
But 6,000 years ago, they weren't all located in that whole area.
No. No, no. Let me tell you what are the theories. First of all, most of the scholars who write about the Indo-European homeland do not attempt to distinguish between the homeland with Anatolian and the homeland without Anatolian. And they ought to, but most of them don't. Second, they use particular words, and they are very much influenced by this desire to have it end up in their own countries. The Germans were absolutely convinced for a long time, of course, calling Indo-European Indo-Germanic, mm-hmm. that it originated somewhere in Germany. And they looked at the word for beach, which is found in a lot of languages, including the English word. Sometimes it means something else. In Greek it means an oak, but never mind. They look at the word for beach, and they say, well, we have to look at the line where the beaches ended. And if we look at that line, they have to be west of that line, and so they have to be basically in Germany. Others say, well, no, look at the word lax for salmon, and where were the salmon at that time? And actually, nobody knows exactly where the salmon were at that time. They make a huge fuss about it, and so on and so forth, that kind of thing. But there are other, nowadays, more scholarly, more refined ideas about homelands. But even so, they don't distinguish sharply between the homeland with and without Anatolian, and that bothers me, because those could be different. With Anatolian, the homeland could be in Anatolia, actually, or in the Caucasus. And without Anatolian, it's generally thought to be up in here, in Russia, just above the Black, above the eastern end of the Black Sea, somewhere up here.
See a map on the next stage like this for the six or seven
homelands. Oh yes, if we can guess the homelands for these things, it's not so easy. It would be wonderful to guess the homelands for the Uralic people, for example. Well, you can do some very good work on it. Let me explain how. Well, the Uralic, it's hard. But you remember there were two branches to Uralic, two big super branches. One of them was Ugro-Finnish, and the other one was the Samoyed languages. Now, if we forget for a moment the Samoyed languages and look for the homeland of the common Fenno-Ugric language, that's not so difficult, because Fenno-Ugric has a number of identifiable words from Iranian. Not common Indo-European, but already Iranian. The word for horn, the word for hundred, the word for... in Hungarian, those of you who know Hungarian know these words, beginning with S.
Let me ask you,
the S indicates they're coming from Iranian, because it's come from that K in the Proto-Indo-European, which has become S in Iranian and Russian and Baltic. So these words in common Fenno-Ugric indicate that these were neighbors of the Iranians when they started, basically. And that's not so very long after the Uralic unity. So you can say pretty much that at least the Fenno-Ugric people were right here, just east of the Indo-Europeans in Russia, somewhere. And a lot of them are still there. The Samoyed were further over, presumably, but maybe they moved into their Siberian location. So this could well be the homeland of Uralic here.
One of the tools used in genetic migration is to use the tree an indicator of,
yes,
geographical movement.
With innovations. Now, there are a lot of people in linguistics who try to use shared innovations to trace the tree. It has some pitfalls in linguistics, but occasionally it's used, and there's some people who like it a lot. Some linguists who like it a lot, others who denounce it. The correct statement is somewhere in between. There is some value to looking at shared innovations, but you have to be sure that their shared innovations are not shared archaisms. They're not, it's not that the people share something that was in the original language. and everybody else has lost it. Mm-hmm. You have to be sure that it's really an innovation on the part of these languages, and they've got it. For example, Italic and Celtic are thought by many people to be together, that there was once an Italo-Celtic unity and it split into Italic and Celtic. So you see certain words which are in common, like terra for earth in Latin and tir in Irish. Tir na n'óg, for example, for those of you who know Irish, the land of the young. This is the same, óg, by the way, is the same word as young. The same in Italic and Celtic. There are quite a few things like that. There are a few grammatical things. Are those really shared innovations that come from mutations in Italo-Celtic, or are they just random things, or are they shared archaisms? You have to know. So it's tricky, but yes, it's true that you can do that. The main thing is we are really trying to work with Luca Cavalli Sforza and Mark Feldman on the genetics, to work with archaeologists, of whom we have quite a few on our list, on the archaeology, work with Christy Turner on the teeth, look at other physical characteristics from physical anthropology, and so on and so forth. These don't give, by any means, isomorphism. Well, you wouldn't expect it. I mean, look at all the Japanese Americans, for example, who don't speak a word of Japanese, even though they look Japanese and they have a lot of Japanese genes, they speak English. So you can't expect the language and the ancestry to be firmly tied together. But they are somewhat tied together. And you can see from the different trees quite a bit of correspondence. Mm-hmm. Luca Cavalli Sforza loves this stuff, and so he's very happy to come and participate.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think the European language has the proto-language?
With the proto-language, Sanskrit. The next closest is Lithuanian. And Russian's pretty good too, but it's Lithuanian. Lithuanian is a museum. that was part of the reason for the movement to try to preserve Lithuanian and Latvian, which had become peasant languages that were on the verge of extinction at the end of the 18th century. The German anthropologist and philosopher Herder argued a lot. I described that in my book, by the way. He argued for the importance of preserving these cultures, the Lithuanian and Latvian cultures, along with their very archaic Indo-European languages. And where many people were thinking at the time of the French Revolution that it would be nice to have one language everywhere and maybe it would contribute to peace. And I learned all this when I asked my father about that. I said, why don't we just have one language in the world and maybe we'd all get along better? And he said, well, think about Herder. And he told me the story of this. Now, of course, it wasn't Herder who did it. He urged it. But there were native Lithuanian and Latvian writers like Donelaitis in Lithuania who really did this kind of thing. Wrote wonderful works in Lithuanian and made it a literary language which could be preserved. And now, of course, they have states. So now it's okay. A language with a foreign office, an army, and so on is not going to disappear very quickly. If it doesn't have a foreign office and an army and so on, then it's called a dialect and it's on its way out.
Are you a Lithuanian background?
No. Nothing to do with Lithuania. You are from Lithuania.
My grandparents.
Your grandparents. Very good.
But he's actually from South Africa.
Stanley Mandelstam also.
Right. They went
to also from Lithuania by way of South Africa.
Sydney Brenner, Stanley Mandelstam.
Yes, and you, yes, the Three Musketeers. So here are some common words.
Mm-hmm.
This is produced, I think, by my colleague Starostin, who's the head of our project. It's a brilliant Russian linguist, is extremely learned. The most important thing is the first and second person pronouns. They are unbelievably conservative. Not only isolated pronouns, but pronouns as endings or beginnings of words, giving the number and person of a verb, for instance, and so on. And Indo-European, of course, we're extremely familiar with for the first person singular in mine, me, the endings of lots of verbs and lots of ancient languages, the first person singular ends in and so on and so forth. In Altaic, Turkic, Mongolic, and Tungusic, it becomes a B. The M becomes a B, but it's pretty obvious that it's the same thing. Here's me in Indo-European, May in Kartvelian. I should have mentioned that the Russian Nostratic scholars put Kartvelian, which is basically Georgian and a few related languages like Svan, Kartvelian and Dravidian, the languages of South India, they put those together with Eurasiatic to make Nostratic. So Stolichin does that here, and so he lists Dravidian and Kartvelian forms, and here it's really, really convincing because they have the same M that we do. Now, may, me. Now what about I?
But does that mean that the other ones that you haven't listed have different forms?
Sometimes it does, yes. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does.
Would make the case a little less convincing.
It would be better to do it that way. He does it on other pieces of paper, but not here. Here he lists the one. You're absolutely right. That would be very good.
Yeah, so for example, Japanese is totally different, right?
No, actually not. Ancient Japanese has an M.
I see, unlike...
Has a word with an M. Or no, a B, sorry, B. Which I think later becomes a W. So I think Japanese is okay, and Korean is okay. Here's the second person singular, which is T or S in these languages, which is exactly the case in Indo-European, and it's the case in a huge number of other languages. You know, the verb ending is S, second person singular a lot, and the isolated pronoun is a T, as in English, thou, thee. Now what about I and me? That's in, you know, huge number of Indo-European languages, you have that. It's called a suppletive situation, where the, in this case, the nominative form comes from one kind of thing, and the rest of the cases come from another. The oblique cases come from something else. Well, Sanskrit gives us a very good idea. It's aham, and then the usual m, things beginning with m. So they reconstruct eghom as the original form, which gives ego in Latin, eho in Greek, I in English, ich, you know, in German, I in English, and so on and so on and so on. All works perfectly. Eghom. Why is it eghom when everything else begins with an M? Well, apparently that M is the same M. It's the first person singular M with some kind of funny word in front of it, like this is me.
I see.
And if you look at Chukchi, that's exactly what you find, and you find it also for the second person singular. I find this impressive. The Stolichin doesn't. Greenberg found it very impressive. I discovered it, so I like it, but Greenberg also discovered it, and he published it, which I didn't. But if you look in the Chukchi dictionary, you'll see that the oblique cases are again mu, 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 just as in everything else, but the I is rum. And second person, thou, is hut. So coming from gut, gum, gut. So there's this initial gu, meaning something like it is. And then m and t. It is I, it is thou. It is me, it is thee. So anyway, that's possibly what happened. But let's look at some more of these things. Clue to hear. Well, that's in Welsh, you know, clear, clear, varial, glad, and so on. Let's hear, hear. We have loud, we have listen, we have all these words that come from clue. In Latin, you have inclitus or inclutus, meaning famous. In Germanic, you have chlud, like Ludovic, Louis, right? Louis, it means famous hero, famous man. Comes from chlud, Chlodovic. That's why we say Clovis for the original king of the Franks, and so on. So this is a very widespread word in Indo-European. But look, here it is in Uralic, here it is in Dravidian, here it is in Kartvelian, Altaic, and so on and so forth. Here's man, occurs very, very frequently in Indo-European, mon, Dravidian man, Uralic, menche, and so on and so forth. This thing, female relative in law, that's a very good one. It's an obscure sounding category, but it's extremely conservative. These words that go with the kinship system of a tribe turn out to be extremely conservative.
Sure.
And this one is not an exception. Look, here it is in Altaic, in Uralic, in Dravidian, in Indo-European, in Kartvelian. He takes just Georgian here.
But can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Why is English so impoverished in this respect, in terms of family relationship, words?
Well, I don't know. We don't have, yeah, we've lost a lot of the kinship, a lot of the traditional Indo-European kinship terms.
Cousins,
we don't,
for example,
I think we've lost the anthropology, the cultural anthropology along with the words.
Cousins is totally a generic word.
Yes, right, right, right. The other languages have words for cross-cousin, words for mother's brother.
Right.
Let me tell you a story about mother's brother. Some of you will find it funny, but Roman Jakobson, the famous linguist who worked after coming to the United States at both Harvard and MIT, said that mama and papa cannot be used as evidence for vertical descent because they are natural sounds for a baby to make. And they're naturally the sounds you would give to a mother and father, and of the two, you would be most likely to give to the mother because the little baby is sucking on the mother, and so on. What he didn't anticipate, as my friend Merritt Rulin keeps pointing out, and as two Frenchmen have written in a beautiful paper that I have here, what is so interesting is that mother's brother and sometimes grandfather have an extremely conservative word. All over the world. It's a funny word because in Indo-European it has a different meaning, which is bowel movement, kaka. But this kaka, which in other languages, is very, very common all around the world. Something kaka or something very like it for mother's brother and often for mother's father and sometimes for elder brother. Mm-hmm. But always with this same connotation.
Because that person is likely to be a protector of some kind.
Well, many cultures, the mother's brother is the one who is like a father in the traditional Indo-European culture. Somebody who's in charge of the family, who tells the young people whom to marry, and that sort of thing. The mother's brother. Because you have, it goes with matrilineal, or originally matrilineal society, where the location of the person after marriage goes with the mother. And, anyway. It's an example that we'll point to later when we talk about the whole world, the world as a whole. So, who are we looking at? Oh, a whole bunch of things here. This word for snow is very nice. He reconstructs it as shingu, but it gives snig in Indo-European, sometimes without the S. Some languages without the S, some languages with the S. It's called the S mobile. In Indo-European, you can take away the S or put it back. But we don't know why, but it's very common in Indo-European.
So in French, it's neige.
Yes, from Latin. Yes. Latin, Russian, snieg. English, snow, and so on and so forth. Very, very common Indo-European. And you have it also in these other families, Altaic and Uralic. There are many other words. Words for many, words for a whole bunch of things. Yes, so Starostin, except that they differ a little bit on what they're talking about. So the Nostraticists include Dravidian and Kartvelian, and they often are not experts in Eskimo and Aleut. Sometimes they are, because there are some Eskimos on the Russian side. The Yupik, some of the Yupik live in Siberia. So they differ a little bit, and the American people who work on this usually leave out Kartvelian and Dravidian. It's clear from something I'll show you in a minute that they are more distantly related than the others, these two branches. Dravidian and Kartvelian, but they probably should be included. Now, originally, Ilyich Svitich also included Afro-Asiatic, which I'll get to in a moment, and includes Semitic, ancient Egyptian, Berber, the languages of the Horn of Africa, and the Hausa and related languages of the Chad region in Africa. He included Afro-Asiatic as part of Nostratic. This was, except by one person, agreed to be a mistake. Afro-Asiatic is an ant, not a member of this group. In other words, it should be put parallel with Eurasiatic and the other superfamilies. It's closely related, but at a different level.
So it's another superfamily.
It's another superfamily which should be put in the same next to Eurasiatic or Nostratic. But there are also borrowings, not only from Afroasiatic, there are borrowings from Semitic into this whole thing, the whole of Indo-European, not the whole Eurasiatic, but the whole of Indo-European. A famous example is the word for seven, which is very peculiar in Indo-European, Latin septem, and similar things in the other languages. Why does it end in EM? And what's going on? Well, septem probably comes from the Semitic, Shabbatum, seventh, with the M at the end, which you have at the end of all the Semitic words in the very ancient Semitic languages. It's called mimation. You stick an M at the end. Sabbath is that word, seventh day. That's the word for seventh. And apparently it was borrowed into Indo-European from Semitic. There's also other words which may have gone either way, like wine, which is almost the same in Semitic and Indo-European, and several other such words. Okay, here's another superfamily. Now here, Starostin played a huge role in the elucidation of this superfamily, but there's some controversy, as you'll see, about the composition of it. It includes the Sino-Tibetan languages, which have been reconstructed by Starostin and others. Starostin first reconstructed Middle Chinese and then Ancient Chinese. He doesn't speak Cantonese, but when he goes to Hong Kong, he speaks Middle Chinese and it works perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Middle Chinese is from...
That's the one you were telling me about.
Which dynasty?
Well, the beginning of the Tang.
Beginning of Tang from when?
Around then.
To?
Then it began changing. But that is, the Cantonese is very conservative and has retained something very close to Middle Chinese as the present language in Canton. Anyway, here's another superfamily. Sino-Tibetan, everybody agrees about Sino-Tibetan, but he's actually done some reconstruction, not only of Chinese, but of Sino-Tibetan, which includes Burmese and other languages. But you need to do much more work on Sino-Tibetan because there are a lot of tribal languages that haven't been included and they ought to be included. Large number of them. Then there's North Caucasian. That's all the languages of the Caucasus except Georgian and its relatives. Chechen is one of them. These North Caucasian languages have very, very, very difficult phonology for us who didn't grow up there. Very hard to pronounce. But he's shown a relationship with Sino-Tibetan.
Really?
Yeah. And also, there seems to be a very close relationship with Yeniseian, spoken way up here in the Arctic, on the Yenisei River. One of the Yeniseian languages is still alive, caught. The others are recorded by old Russian expeditions. Then you have Nadjiden, which is in America, and includes Athabascan, which includes the Apache languages, including Navajo, and Tlingit and Haida, up in this area. And probably Basque goes into this superfamily too, and probably also the isolated language Burushaski, which is the language of Hunza on the border of a territory claimed by Pakistan in the Himalayas. So probably all of these form a superfamily, which we can call Diné Caucasian. Starostin doesn't know much about Nadine, so he leaves it out, and it's not spoken in Russia, so he sticks mostly to these languages in his work, but he ought to include Nadine as well, and some people do. And this looks pretty good. This is another 12,000-year-old or 10,000-year-old superfamily.
Your map doesn't show South Africa, South America. South America is also Nadine?
No. No, it's not. The furthest the Nadine people got in America was just below the Mexican border, where you had a few Apaches. Just a few miles south of the Mexican border of the U.S., and then it stops.
Most of your maps haven't shown the southern hemisphere.
That's correct. Now, there are other things going on in the southern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a map of the world. Somewhere, do I have it? Let's see, where is it? Sorry I'm going so slowly, but people are asking wonderful questions, and...
Now, Murray, if you want to take a break, even though...
No, I don't want to take a break. If you guys want a break, that's different. I don't need a break. I love talking about this stuff.
No, I love...
Just amazed that anyone wants to hear it, but
no,
if you want to hear it, I'm delighted to supply it.
Okay, but
But I'm trying to find a map of the world here. Well, I'll get to one later. I don't know where it is.
Now, even though you told me you were 29
yes.
this morning.
Yes.
You may wanna...
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
That's fine. Let's go on. You can't find a map. Okay.
No. Here are some examples of word lists with a lot of words. Ashes, bark, belly. These are some conservative words. Big, bird, bite, black, and so on and so on and so forth. Pages and pages of these
things. How many superfamilies?
Something like a dozen around the world. And Joe found four in Africa, and I'll tell you what they are. Afroasiatic, which goes slightly into Asia, that includes Semitic, ancient Egyptian and Coptic, Berber, the languages of the Horn of Africa, which are called Cushitic and Omotic, and the Chadic languages, including Hausa, down near Lake Chad in Africa, black African languages. And that Afroasiatic superfamily is quite well understood. But it still needs some more work, and especially reconstruction of proto-language. The various people who have done it don't agree. They disagree more than usual. And a lot of more work has to be done. But it's a very nice superfamily. Everybody agrees on it. Even the conservative people agree on it. Then there are three more. There's Niger-Congo, which is basically West African, including Bantu. All the Bantu languages are in Niger-Congo. And Niger-Congo can be extended to include some languages of the oases of the Sahara, so it becomes Niger-Kordofanian. But that's a minor point. Then in East Africa, you have, apart from the Bantu, who are Niger-Congo, you have the Nilo-Saharan languages in the Sahara and along the Nile, like Nubian and lots of other such languages. These are very big and very old, but very little has been done on the reconstruction of the Nilo-Saharan and Niger-Congo. But then the remaining African languages have these click sounds that are used as regular consonants, usually in combination with other consonants. So you have sometimes five clicks in Bushman languages, for instance. San, we call them today. Politically correct word is San. In the San languages, you have five clicks sometimes, combined with about nine other consonants to make 45 click sounds, all at the beginnings of words. 45 click sounds. But anyone can do this, if growing up among the people who speak the languages. If any of you has grown up in those places, you can do it. Clicks are a side click, which we use, but to urge on a horse or something. We don't use it as part of a word. That is a beautiful idea. No, we don't say things like that. There's another one. Another one is from the front of the mouth, from the back of the mouth, and so on. But they're combined with K's and G's and H's, and it's a nightmare. Now these include the San or Bushman languages, the Kwekwe or Hottentot languages, which are part of it, and they're actually part of one of the branches of the Bushman languages. And then in Tanzania, there are two hunting and gathering tribes that speak these languages, Hadza and Sandawe. And without Hadza and Sandawe, some classification has been done and some reconstruction. With Hadza and Sandawe, the materials aren't so great. They haven't really worked it out too well yet. But these four families in Africa are recognized by everybody. And that's very strange, because most professional historical linguists reject superfamilies altogether. They say as soon as you go beyond 6,000 or 7,000 years, as soon as you go beyond our specialties, Indo-European, Uralic, Malayo-Polynesian, and so on and so on. As soon as you go beyond those, it's all nonsense. It's unscientific, it's rubbish. These ideas must be shouted down, they say. Very scientific. And the reason, they say, is that you can't reconstruct the proto-language, you can't reconstruct the sound system and the sound changes, and it's all baloney. Unscientific baloney. Well, they're obviously wrong. It takes one sentence to show that they're wrong, two or three sentences to show that they're wrong. If they were right, then the evidence for Indo-European, Uralic, Austronesian, and so on, would be marginal. And then, of course, it would be hard to go beyond. But the evidence, even as we've seen today, is so overwhelming that if you had 1% of it, you would believe in Indo-European and Uralic and so on and so on. So it's crazy to suppose that you have to stop there. Unless, before 4000 BC, it was mainly horizontal transfer, and vertical transfer didn't exist, and there was no such thing as a Stammbaum, but I don't know any reason to believe that that's true. So, what is done by people that we work with is just to try to carry on scientifically, using the sound systems, using the reconstruction of proto-language, using all these things, using the known proto-languages, so as to carry you one step beyond the present, and so on and so forth. And it seems to work moderately well. So we think that these conservative professors just are trying to defend their territories. And that's what happened to Greenberg. In the 1950s, the Africanists attacked him like crazy. And in this field, it's not like physics. If you study linguistics for a few days, you'll come back to physics with an enormous sigh of relief. I mean, they don't call you lousy, nasty names so much in the physics literature. But in the linguistic literature, it's the no holds barred. And
errors do accumulate as you go up.
Oh yes, it gets harder and harder, everybody agrees. It gets more and more approximate as you go back further and further in time. The sound system is a little less reliable, but it never was so reliable as they say. And the reconstruction of the proto-language is a little more uncertain, but always was somewhat uncertain, and now it gets a little more uncertain. But from the work that's been done, we seem to think that it's okay. But what's peculiar is that these conservative people lost the Battle of Africa at the end of the 1950s to Joe Greenberg. And they gave up, they surrendered, and they've never tried to reconquer Africa. So they talk about Niger Congo and Nilo-Sahara cheerfully, even though they're just as old, just as problematic, based on exactly the same kind of reasoning as Eurasiatic and...
6,000.
No, 12. 10, 12.
But if I look at the numbers,
yes.
It's like, you know, each branch is about a factor of 10. So there's one more stage or two more stages?
We don't know. I would guess two more, namely one super set of super families, of which there might be three or something like that, and then I would guess one single ancestor for everything. That's a guess. Not necessarily. The Eve and the Adam come this way, as you know. They look at mitochondrial DNA, which goes through the woman always, and they reconstruct a female ancestress of all of us. Then they look at the Y chromosome, which always goes through the man, and they reconstruct a male common ancestor for all of us. And then they look back at when those existed.
And they weren't married.
No, don't have to be married.
At the same time,
huh? I don't know what kind of marriage ceremonies they had at that time, anyway. We know from cartoons, right? The man with his club dragging the woman by the hair. But anyway. What was I going to say? We don't know who those people were, what they looked like, whether they were even people. All we know is that they were the common ancestor, male and female, common ancestors, male and female, of everybody alive today. Mm-hmm. So that's only good for order of magnitude. And the order of magnitude there is something over 100,000 years, which does agree with the archaeological evidence for anatomically modern people in Africa. So it's quite possible that they were among the early anatomically modern people in Africa some 100,000 years ago, which just seems to be roughly the age. But
patterns of genetic.
But then they found lineages coming from Eve, as you call her, nine lineages and then sublineages. And now Mark Feldman is working not just with mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome DNA, but all the other chromosomes too. And they're beginning to find all sorts of other wonderful information about early typing and early migrations, early race, if you like. And they're very anxious to compare it with the linguistic data. Not that they have to be the same, but that there should be some correlations.
Well, on that time scale, one or two more stages seems a bit early.
Right. You're absolutely correct. And here's what I would say about it. I think that if you go back 40,000 years to an original language, or less, that it would leave some traces. If you look at this glotto chronology, even though the numbers with the 14% don't come out so good, if you extend it to allow a little semantic drift, then I think you could reconstruct, you could see today some evidences of relationship across the world at 40,000 years. If it's 150,000 years, forget it. You're not going to see anything. But the 40,000 years is a pretty nice number, because it looks as if modern people came out of Africa once, around maybe 110,000 BC, something like that, as far as Palestine, and then quit, because there's no evidence anymore of those people. But then again, around 50,000 years ago, they left Africa, and that was something that persisted. And they curled around into Europe at around 40,000 BC to start the Auric Nation, the Upper Paleolithic, in Western Europe, with all those marvelous caves with the paintings and sculpture and engravings and dance steps and the clay and these wonderful tools. And not only Europe, but they went into Asia, and they went all the way to New Guinea and Australia. Now, in Australia, they used to quote 62,000 years, which is a little upsetting if they started at 40,000 years ago. But they just changed it from 62 to 42 plus or minus 5 or something like that. So I'm very happy about that. So it looks as if maybe 40,000 years ago there was an explosion of people and a behavioral explosion with a huge amount of creative work, like the art in the European caves. And for that to be the time when modern language was begun or invented or whatever you want to call it, that would be marvelous. Now, that doesn't mean that people before that didn't have some kind of sounds. Lots of animals communicate with sounds, but modern language is very special. And all modern languages are pretty much alike in this respect. They have huge vocabularies, they have huge, difficult grammars, all of them. They have, you can string together as many clauses and adjectives and adverbs and so on as you want. You can say pretty much anything you can think. And modern languages are a very special phenomenon, and undoubtedly different from the grunts or whatever it is that our remote ancestors used to communicate like the other animals. So modern language is a thing. It may have developed over some time, some thousands of years perhaps, but it was a definite thing, and not just like other kinds of communication. And there's a huge similarity in the grammars. Furthermore, in doing this world survey of super families, as or super families as claimed by various unorthodox scholars, we find a lot of widespread roots getting in the way. You look at a claimed language family somewhere in Southeast Asia, in New Guinea, wherever, and you say, oh look, there's a lot of evidence for these languages being related, because we have this long list of words, roughly the same in many of these languages. And then you notice that some of those words are also in Uralic, Indo-European, Semitic, and so on and so on. And it looks as if these must be words inherited from a primordial language. So while there's no scientific argument for monogenesis, for a single ancestor, there is a lot of suspicious looking anecdotal evidence that's very interesting. And if I had to bet personally, I would bet on it actually. But I can't say that it's been scientifically established at all. And what we're trying to do in the project, besides consulting with geneticists, tooth people, archaeologists, other cultural anthropologists, so on and so forth, is to try to understand the early migrations and their relation to these superfamilies, and maybe the superfamilies put into superfamilies. For example, Afroasiatic and Eurasiatic are surely related, and there may be others. Now, I didn't find the map of the world, but you all want to see it, I know. Let me see here if I can find it.
Do you want to help while you talk?
No. I'll find it.
Oh, you're skipping all this?
Well, I want to find the map of the world. What the heck happened to it? Somebody stole my map of the world. He's busy with high crimes and misdemeanors. He doesn't have time for these petty. Here we are. Here it is. Oh no, it's not. Oh yes, yes it is. Yes it is. Yes it is. It is. It is. It's not quite what I want to say, but almost. So here are the suggested superfamilies. We've talked about Eurasiatic.
Right.
We talked about Dine Caucasian. That's here, the vertical stripes.
Right.
Okay. Then I've told you about Afro-Asiatic. That's these diagonal stripes. Then I told you about Niger-Congo. You see the Bantu have spread all the way around here, but originally Niger-Congo was in this West African area. And then here's Nilo-Saharan over on this side, the little horizontal lines. That's not Nilo-Saharan. Here is Khoisan.
That's Khoisan too, isn't it?
Khoisan, huh?
Khoisan, is that Khoisan?
No, Hosa. Hosa, which white South Africans like to call Khoza. It's actually Hosa. Hosa. Isi Hosa is the language of the Aba Hosa, who are a Bantu people.
So it's
closely related to the Aba Zulu, who speak Isi Zulu. And they're all called Nguni, these people. And they are Bantu who immigrated relatively recently, in the last few centuries, into southern Africa.
Okay.
Southern Africa was more the bastion of, you know, Kwekwe and San people. But there were some Bantu a long time ago. It's only Cape Province that had very few Bantu when the Europeans arrived. The rest of today's South Africa actually had some Bantu. The old apartheid people claimed that there weren't Bantu in South Africa. That's not true. It's just Cape Province. Anyway, here's Khoisan. I told you about Niger-Congo or Niger-Kordofanian. Here's Nilo-Saharan and so on. Then we have the rest of the world. Now, everything else in America that is not Nadine or Eskimo Aleut, Joe Greenberg put in one big, big, big superfamily that he called Amerind. All the other American languages. And instead of the m-t or m-s pattern for the first and second person singular pronouns, you have k, no, sorry, you have n, m. N for the first person, m for the second person. Very common. Hmm. And lots of other words in common. And but it's not scientific, and these Americanists are the worst of the conservative historical linguists. They are impossible. Joe Greenberg was called the worst possible names in print by these people for daring to suggest that their individual fields were subfields of Amerind. Ooh. It goes back to the Africanists when they attacked Joe Greenberg in the 40s and 50s. But these people are worse. I mean, Guthrie, who was defending Bantu and saying it was nothing bigger than Bantu, it was isolated, it was, you know. He was at least relatively polite in an old British tradition, but these Americanists, they're the living end. They're nice people otherwise, but you tell them that their field is a sub field of Amerind, and they go wild! So that's discouraged research on Amerind.
Okay.
But I would like to include it.
None of your discussions,
yes.
Have you used grammar and syntax at
all? Right. I haven't used grammar and syntax. You don't need to, but let me say a few words about it.
But you could go back to them.
And see whether there aren't some things, using the other evidence, that are conservative too, right, from grammar. Exactly.
Or figure out what the
exactly
rules
right
are for grammar.
Exactly right.
You know what the structure is.
Right. And I believe that my friends and I have identified two or three items like that. One of them is ergative construction. Has anyone here ever heard of ergative construction?
Raise your hand.
No. It goes like this. In English, we have a in languages that you've heard of, we have a nominative form for the subject of a sentence, like I.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether the verb is transitive or intransitive. It's still I. And then we have an object form, me, the object of a transitive verb. An intransitive verb, of course, doesn't have an object, so we don't need anything for that. In an ergative language, you have instead one word for the object of a transitive, one case, I mean, for the object of a transitive verb and the subject of an intransitive verb. And the other case is for the subject of a transitive verb. there's a different distribution of cases. Now, this is a fairly conservative trait. It does spread by borrowing, but it looks as if it doesn't do so all that much, and a lot of it is descent. Another thing is word order. People have made models, and I tried for some years to make a model of word order transformation that would allow for a kind of equilibrium that had been reached in the world among word orders. So you would have a transition matrix from one kind of word order to another, and we would have a sort of equilibrium established with this transition matrix after a while. Turns out not to work. Looks much more as if there was an original word order that we can recover, and there have been changes from that, and sometimes changes back, but not changes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Maybe once or twice or something like that. And we believe the original word order was the word order that you find in Japanese, Turkish, so on and so on and so forth. And we think originally in Indo-European, although not in the modern, most of the modern Indo-European languages. Namely, subject, object, verb, and what statistically and also theoretically goes with that, which is postpositions instead of prepositions, and adjective before the noun, and things like that. The relative before the noun, a whole bunch of such rules which tend to go with the word order subject, object, verb. And my friends and I believe, and we're trying to write something about this, that from that original word order, one has made, in some places in the world, some changes toward the opposite stable pole, which is verb at the beginning, and then subject, and then object, adjective after the noun, prepositions, and so on and so forth. And that's also quite a stable state. And so we don't think it's gone back and forth a million times. We think in some parts of the world it's gone once to the other stable state. You see some things in between, and maybe it's bounced off the stable state at the other end once, back into the middle. But not a huge number of transitions back and forth. So those are examples we conjecture of things that may be something like lexical items in that they're conservative enough in the vertical transmission to help you. Yes?
You have to be very careful, isn't that right?
Oh boy, there are people out with knives, poniards, swords to get us.
To distinguish between grammar and syntax, because I've read the statement that the Chinese has syntax but not grammar.
Well, I don't know. Chinese grammar is a lot like English, only a little more so. Namely, there aren't a lot of cases anymore. There used to be some cases.
But
we still have two words for I, which are descended from two cases, I and me, in ancient Chinese. But mostly you have an analytic structure that is separate words, which we have mostly in English too. Chinese has no endings like ing and so on and so on. It's all separate words and particles.
So there's no grammar.
Well, the grammar is word order. No. You depart from word order in Chinese, you're dead.
Sure.
Because there isn't anything else. Now, in Latin poetry, you can louse up the word order as much as you want. There's no limit. Because there are cases and verb endings for tenses, and you read the sentence no matter how you write, no matter in what order you write the words. And Latin poetry is to do that. Chinese text, as you know, you get the words out of order, it doesn't mean anything anymore. It means something completely different. So that's Chinese situation. There are other languages like that, and English approaches it.
Approaching
that. English is not so very different. Yes? Oh, universal grammar, yes. Associated with my old friend, Noam Chomsky. Yes, he pointed out many, many, many years ago that you can argue that perhaps children don't learn from their experience enough of the grammar of their native language to be able to produce that grammar from nothing. And that therefore, every child must be born with some hardwired fraction of grammar, which would be universal for all people in all languages. And then what the child learns is the rest of the set of rules. He's never specified what these fundamental underlying hardwired rules are. He's just given them different names over the years. Nowadays he talks about, what is it, something or other and parameters. There's a basic grammar and then parameters which the children learn, and so on. Anyway, he may be right. I'm not sure. So there are some people who contradict his evidence and say that this, what's it called, paucity or inadequacy of data or something for the child is not correct. But it may be correct. But it doesn't say much for what we're interested in, because it's the if so, it would be the rest of the grammar that we're talking about, and the choice of words, the choice of lexical items. So Noam, if Noam is right that a certain portion of grammar is hardwired, it doesn't really affect what we do substantially.
Is there any estimate of the size of the vocabulary of these languages as you go back? Does it get?
Well, they recover. Stottischen typically recovers when he does very, very liberal work, not just these few meanings. But he looks, as I showed in those long transparencies, he looks at lots and lots of words and uses some semantic shift. Tongue to language, hand to arm, you know, all this sort of thing. Allows some semantic shift, not what you do in glottal chronology. Then he begins to discover roots. And he typically finds 1,500, 2,000 roots, something like that, that are relatively easy to discover with some uncertainty, some error, some allowance for being wrong, but something of that order of magnitude. Yes?
Would you expect that West African languages are closer to that proto language, given that people would expect migration to come from West Africa?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Would you expect that the West African languages are actually closer to the proto language? Because out of Africa.
Between the proto language of all. Well, we don't have such good evidence. This, of course, assumes monogenesis. It assumes monogenesis in Africa before the explosion of people and ideas and so on out of Africa, maybe 50,000 years ago. I don't know why you picked Niger-Congo. Why not Nilo-Sahara and why not Khoisan? Khoisan is the more associated with the more primitive people, as we call them, in Africa, hunters-gatherers and so on. Herders in the case of the Kwekwe, but that may be relatively recent. And many people would believe that perhaps what happened is that Khoisan was the first family to hive off, and then the other people moved up. But we don't have enough data to, linguistic data, to say anything about that. We will sometime. We've done a lot of work on Khoisan. The main thing that our project is doing is putting together a public database so that everybody can see all the stuff and draw conclusions. That's not what the typical linguists do. But we're trying to get every reconstruction that anybody has ever done onto a public database, all the dictionaries and all the 100-word lists from all over the world onto a public database, and so on. That's the main thing we will contribute. The rest of it is this very interesting theoretical work, which of course we love, but the main contribution, I think, there's something that will certainly be useful for the future, is the database. Yes, back there. Basque. Oh, I said that as far as these people are concerned, the best guess they can make is that it is part of the Dine-Caucasian system. So that's Nadine in the Americas, Yeniseian in the Arctic area of Siberia, the North Caucasus, including Chechen and languages like that, the languages of Dagestan, and Burushaski in the Himalaya. And what did I leave out? Oh, and Sino-Tibetan. How could I leave that out? And Sino-Tibetan, which is Chinese, Tibetan, Burmese, and so on and so forth. Basque seems to fit in there. But the evidence is, when there's one language, it's a little tricky to fit it in. If there were 15 languages of which Basque is a member, a group of 15 languages of which Basque is a member, it would be better. Now, actually, there may be two or three. Because we can't read ancient Iberian. We know how to read, how to sound the symbols, which are either letters or syllables, depending on the case. We can pronounce ancient Iberian, but we don't know what the words mean. If someday a bilingual is discovered, then we can add Iberian, which is almost certainly related somehow to Basque. And maybe Tartessian is different in the part of Spain that the Bible calls Tarshish. Tartessus, near you know, near where Columbus left for America. That may also be another one. Example, which is mountain in Basque. You know, there's a Senator John Garamendi in California who sponsored the self-esteem law. Anyway, high, it means high mountain. Mendi could come from Latin montem, and most Vasconists say it does. But other people see connections in Sino-Tibetan and Burushaski and so on. So there's a lot of controversy about Basque. But the best guess is that it's part of that superfamily. Yes?
So you mentioned a few vocabulary similarities between Indo-European and Semitic.
Yes, it looks as if, first of all, they may be related as ant and Semitic. They may be related as first cousins. That's one possibility. Second is borrowings. The ones I mentioned were borrowings, yes, certainly borrowings. It's a long story, but they looked into it fairly carefully and they don't think there's... it's only in one branch of Eurasiatic, only Indo-European.
Right.
And it's only in one branch of Afro-Asiatic, namely Semitic. So it looks like a contact. Where that contact occurred is interesting. Were there some Semitic people up in the Caucasus, for example? Did the contacts occur by boat? Were there primordial Indo-Europeans down in Anatolia with Semitic people nearby? How did it happen? We don't know. But that Shabbatum looks marvelous. Another one that might have been borrowed, perhaps in the opposite direction, is the word for star and the Semitic goddess Ishtar, who was Venus, the planet Venus. And that sounds so much like sterla, the ster part of sterla in Indo-European, which gives star in English, stella in Latin, and so on and so on and so forth.
Also the words for king.
Which one is that? Which word for king?
Ras.
Oh, that's head. Ras is head. Hebrew rosh.
Right, but it's king.
Arabic ras. It's used for a head of a tribe or something, but it means head. Yes, that comes from rego, to rule, and it's a rex in Latin. Oh, it's the Indo-European, it's all the way through.
It's the same as Raj
what?
Ras and Rosh.
No, I don't think so, no. That means, maybe, but that means head. That means head. No, it may be, they may be related, but I don't think so. I think it's regularly head. Yes.
Coming from your perspective as a physicist,
yes.
Do you see any evidence that language is related to creativity, imagination, physical insight?
You mean one language as opposed to another?
Yeah, and therefore there are certain languages which are more likely...
Yes, I've heard that a lot. I'm not too fond of that idea. I've heard a lot that the way you think is very much tied up in your language. Lots of philosophers, linguists, historians, all sorts of people say that, and that there's certain ways of thinking associated with your particular language which may be more or less favorable to certain kinds of inventions, certain kinds of work. I'm very skeptical of that. Let's take the example of Japanese. Japanese was a very straightforward Altaic language to start with. But a few hundred years AD, it began to import Chinese word by the carload. And it has them in different forms, you know, the Chinese words of the first wave, the Chinese words of the second wave, and so on and so on. The three, actually, altogether. And then, nowadays, three. Two of them very common. The Onyomi, you have Go-on and Kan-on, but there's a third one, To-on, Tang Dynasty. They added all these words, and nowadays English words and so on, Latin words, Dutch words, but mainly English these days. Also, they began to add conventions of courtesy. So there's a set of words you use for talking up, set of words you use for talking down, another set of words you use for talking straight across to an equal, and all sorts of special paraphrastic habits, circumlocutions, hesitancy in contradicting something because it's impolite, unless it's said by an inferior. You don't, if possible, you don't try to contradict anything. As a marvelous example, Yuval Ne'eman came to me one day and said, "I'm so ashamed of the Hebrew Encyclopedia," he said. "Hebrew Encyclopedia discusses Yukawa, and it says that his prediction of the meson, followed by the discovery of the muon, brought him great fame. And I said, well, yeah, that sounds as if it was written by a Japanese. Didn't point out that the muon was not your colorless particle. Anyway, Yuval was very upset. So I said, well, let's look at the Encyclopedia Britannica. He said, fine, that's what I came over for. I wanted to look at the Encyclopedia. So we looked at the Encyclopedia Britannica, and it said something like, after Yukawa proposed the meson, the discovery of the muon brought him great fame. He said, well, it's not the Israelis who are causing the problem here. What was the signature at the bottom of the article? Can anyone guess? What were the initials at the bottom of the article? YN. Yoichiro Nambu, the Japanese-American. But he didn't want to be impolite by pointing out that the muon was not Yukawa's part. Okay, now Japanese is used like that, right, in this funny way. Even though it started out as a very straightforward language, it's gotten all this complication of courtesy and different kinds of language for talking up and down and across. And the you would think, especially with his habit of not wanting to come out and contradict anything, that this would be a very poor language for science, and Japanese are just no good at science, right? Wrong. They're marvelous at science. It's baloney. They do the science with this crazy way of writing certain things, but they do the science perfectly well. It doesn't obstruct them. It maybe cause them a hardship. Not to have a habit of not directly contradicting things and so on, but I don't think it ruins their science. I just don't believe it. Funny thing happened after the war. In the Japanese journal, International Journal of Theoretical Physics, they wrote very, very politely in Japanese style, in English. And then they discovered, a couple of years after the war, that the English-speaking people didn't write like that at all. So they suddenly became very abusive for a little while in English. They overcorrected for a couple of years. Yes?
Now, when you put up the list of, 100 conservative words,
100 relatively conservative meanings, yes.
Conservative words.
Yes.
You mentioned a 14% evolution per 1,000 years.
Separation, yes. Yeah, that's a crude, very, very crude thing.
Now,
yeah.
First part is, how do you measure that 14% evolution in the words? Are you including the change of a word, or are you including also the magnitude of changes in words?
No, not the magnitude. You're looking at the following. It has to be refined. It's extremely crude, and it's not right, but it's the original form of the proposal, and so I'm giving it to you as a zeroth approximation. You look at the words using very little semantic shift. Even though often there is a lot of semantic shift, when there's a lot of semantic shift, you treat it as if the word had been changed, okay? As if it were no longer there in the right place. And then you just look at the difference in words that's occurred. For example, Latin head is caput, right? Cognate to English head. But Spanish, in Italian and French, it's testa, or tête in French, from a word for a potsherd.
For testicle.
No, for a potsherd, testa.
No, testicle.
No, testicle comes from testis.
Yes.
Testis is the male organ, the ball. And testis comes from the word for witness, because it was thought that the sperm are just witnesses. It's the egg that produces the... But later on, they thought it was only the sperm that contributed, and the egg was just the nutritious, was there only for nutrition.
I thought it's because before they had the Bible, you had to put your hands on your balls and you give.
Sorry, it's what's called an urban legend. Now, what were we talking about? No, what was the first part? I've forgotten. We got interrupted with this. Yes. When the word is different after a while, like for example, Latin caput becomes testa in Italian and French, but in Spanish, it's still cabeza, right? Or to eat, which is edere in Latin. In Spanish, they use comedere, which gives comer. While in French and Italian, they use the word for the clown with the big mouth, who was the glutton, manduca, which gives you manducare, for to eat, which gives manger, mangiare in Italian, mangia in Provençal, and so on and so on. So, that's an example of, you know, separation.
Murray,
since
what's the second part? I want to hear the second part of this question.
The second part of the question is there a correlation, are there different rates of evolution in languages and different parts of the world? Like, are people that live in equatorial regions, do their languages morph faster?
Yeah, that's a very good question. A very good question. We're trying to look into that. I have arguments with Starostin about that. Starostin claims that the rate of change has slowed down in the last few thousand years. I claim that his evidence for that is mostly from writing, because how else does he know? And maybe it's in places that had writing that it slowed down in the last few thousand years. But he says no, because it's similar in other languages that didn't have writing, as you can tell from the descendants. And so we're arguing about it. I don't know how that will come out. But it's an interesting set of questions.
But that might make sense, because some of the trends you talked about, especially syntactical and grammatical, are one way.
Yes.
So you should reach some fixed point. I mean, for example, grammatically, as you say, Chinese has sort of reached the end. There's not more simplification.
No, no, but you see, it can go in cycles. The older view,
the older view
is that once you reach the analytic stage, like Chinese, or almost that stage, like English, you can then start with these particles. Chinese has a particle for the past tense, for example. That particle could be added on to the verb. Then, for different verbs with different phonology, that particle could get modified in different ways, in which case it's now part of the word. After all, all these tense markers in Latin, for instance, for the conjugations, they were originally words that were stuck on, but then they began to change according to the phonology of the root, and so then they were really stuck on.
So is there evidence of that happening?
Well, I don't believe that it went back and forth like this many times to equilibrium, which was a position I tried to maintain for some years. I think it's gone mostly one way and then maybe bounced back once or one and a half times, but enough so you can follow it. I mean, a little enough so that you can still follow it, and that it's not a matter of going to a completely random situation with a statistical distribution of language types. I don't think that's true.
Now, let me use my prerogative, since it's almost 2 hours.
Yes.
Have a bathroom break. I'd like to hear the rest of the story, but perhaps some people would like to come back in 10 minutes. How's that?
Whatever you want, or maybe some people want to terminate. I don't know. Whatever they want.
So come back in 10 minutes.
Whatever they want.
So part two in 10 minutes.
This is the bottom part, you know, when I was helping you to look for the map.
I found the map.
Yeah, you found the map, but I don't know if it's out of order. Is it in order?
I don't know where it was.
Okay.
I lost it. It's still lost, but it's out there now, so we know.
Do you want to take a drink? Or
yeah, a drink.
Why don't you have a drink, and then we can discuss with people later?
Yeah.
Why don't you have a chance to...
Yeah, that's fine.
That sounds very...
Well, what?
Yeah, yes.
Maybe we should... Let
no, go ahead.
You want to... Okay.
What?
Where one can read something about all this?
Very little you can read. The Altaic Dictionary has just come out. You can look at that. Starostin and his colleagues have now got, later this year it's going to be printed, a dictionary this thick, etymological dictionary of Turkic, Mongolic, Tungusic, Korean, and Japanese, including all the ancient forms. And with all the etymological relations, all the sound shifts, all the reconstructions of the proto-Altaic words, it's a brilliant piece of work. And there are great scholars of Turkic, Mongolic, and Tungusic languages who don't believe any of it. It's so crazy. Oh, hi, bud. I haven't seen you for a long time. How are you doing?
I didn't want to miss this chance.
Oh, great.
Cicely came along, too. You had dinner with her.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, of course. I remember.
How nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
My name is Framelson. I'm glad to hear you.
Hello. What is your name?
Framelson.
Oh, yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Would you have any comments on the complexity or grammar of a language as a function of time?
A little bit, yeah. I'm a student of complexity, so I try to learn something about it.
Obviously, start simple, becomes increasingly more complex.
All modern languages have a considerable degree of complexity. There is no such thing as a simple language that's somebody's first language. Now, there are pidgins and jargons, trade jargons and so on, that are very simple. They have very simple rules, very limited vocabulary, which they use over and over and over again. And those exist, but those are not somebody's native language. Uh-huh. Once something has been people's native language for one or two generations, it's no longer called a pidgin or a jargon, it's called a creole or regular language, and they're all complex. Now, maybe they have different levels of complexity, but they're all quite complex.
Well, you could argue, for example, that the French, Spanish, and Italian are simpler versions of Latin.
Oh, they're a little bit creolized, is the way to say it.
Creolized.
Somewhat creolized. English is somewhat creolized, too, because the Germanic endings and all that disappeared a couple of hundred years after the Norman conquest. So English is also somewhat creolized. The modern Scandinavian languages, at least not, apart from Icelandic and the language of the Faroe,
yes.
They are creolized.
Well, the Icelandic, of course, is very complex.
It's not creolized. It's a regular, highly complex language. But the creolized languages are still complex. They've just worn off certain grammatical features, but they're still very complex. There's no such thing as a simple language that's the native language of a lot of people for a couple of generations or more. They all have a certain minimum amount of complexity. And that's what a lot of colonial settlers in various places have never understood. For example, it's only recently with the written works of Dixon in Australia that the Australian public began to realize that the Aboriginal languages were exceedingly complex. Those English-speaking Australians imagined that the native languages of Australia had 6 or 8 words and, you know, a few grunts and no grammar and so on. In fact, the grammar is exceedingly complex and very interesting. And that's true all over the world. It's contrary to what the racists of the 19th century thought.
So much for eugenics.
Well, eugenics is a whole different subject. It's a different subject.
In this group of 100 stable, relatively unchanged words,
yeah.
Is there any reason to believe that the words from mother persist?
I explained that since Kaka works for uncle and his world looks worldwide in its distribution, mother's brother, sometimes mother's father, sometimes elder brother, it looks as if there's no reason why mama couldn't be an inherited word too, rather than the natural expression of a baby sucking, which is what Roman Jakobson said, particularly papa and dada, which are also worldwide. Why should those be baby words? I mean, any more than kaka for an uncle. And nobody has suggested that kaka for an uncle is a natural baby word. So the whole thing is bizarre.
I was thinking in Russian, for example, it sounds very much like the word from Madre and so forth.
Oh, but of course that's because it's the same word, the Indo-European word, Matir.
Otets doesn't sound anything.
Huh?
Otets for father doesn't sound
anything.
Otets. Yeah, Otets is, it's just like Ata in Gothic, and Tata in lots of other languages, and Dada in other languages.
But not the
it's not Papa, no. No, 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 no. It's the other one. It's the Ata, Ada, Dada, that one. It's Ata in Gothic. The diminutive is Attila, little father. And you remember that's what the Hun leader called himself, because his court spoke Gothic as well as Hunnic. Hunnic was probably Turkic, but his court spoke Gothic a lot of the time. And his name was probably Gothic, Attila, little father. Little father is in Russian plays, you know, Russian 19th century literature translated into English. Please, little father.
So the Semitic word.
Yeah, it's a Russian word. Sicily.
Oh.
Now, she's doing very well, but if she speaks English, you understand.
Sure, yeah.
Do you think that, say, Bulgarian and Macedonian, if you know, have any knowledge of them?
Yes, I do.
Are different languages?
That's a political question. They're very close. You could call Macedonian a dialect of Bulgarian, which the Bulgarian politicians all do. They say the Macedonians are nothing but sub-branch of Bulgarian. The Macedonian politicians like to say that Macedonian is a separate language. And of course, they try to make it a separate language by emphasizing certain words that are different from Bulgarian and adding in a few more and inventing a few new ones that are different from Bulgarian. My friend Louis Gracios was the director of Site Santa Fe, a marvelous art museum in Santa Fe. He's the only Macedonian American you're likely to meet.
Okay.
And his profession is to head art museums. And he had a Bulgarian guest coming. And he said, Murray, what shall I do? I needed somebody who knows Bulgarian. This man speaks only Bulgarian. I said, don't worry, you speak Bulgarian. And they, sure enough, Lewis talked Slavic Macedonian, and the other guy spoke Bulgarian. They understood each other perfectly well. So they're mutually comprehensible.
I should present myself, maybe. I'm Sergei Pitkov.
Oh, you're Pitkov.
Yes, I'm Bulgarian.
I see. How nice. So you know the answers to all these questions.
No, I just...
You just wanted to test me. Oh,
I will write these big letters. Yeah. Murray said...
Was there anything wrong with what I said?
No. I completely agree with you.
this new Eurasiatic sort of superfamily.
Yes.
Previously there was sort of a view that the Finno-Ugric languages,
yes,
and the Altaic languages,
yes,
are somehow related.
Well, they're in there, both of them.
They're in there, but are they, you know...
It turned out that they should be put in... Yes. There is some slight evidence that within Eurasiatic, or Nostratic, whichever you want to call it, that the Uralic and Altaic languages may have a slightly closer link.
Uh-huh.
Than some of the other, than slightly. Uh-huh. But that's not, it's not strong enough, the evidence isn't strong enough to be worth much. I'll show you this matrix, if I get to it, that Sergei, matrix of similarity in the fundamental words that Sergei constructed. And it gives a slightly higher coefficient for the entry under Uralic and Altaic than it does to Uralic and Indo-European and Altaic and Indo-European. But it's not necessarily a significant difference. It's something like 0.25 instead of 0.23 and 0.21, something like that.
Also, what I was saying before with the Semitic, you know, word for, you know, king or head or whatever you have.
Oh, that's head. It's head. It means head.
Well, but I think it can also mean ruler, right?
Sometimes it can mean ruler, but it means, it also means admiral. Raisi, for example, in Italian, is an admiral. Punta Raisi, near Nino has his school, right? Erice.
So you don't
Punta Raisi, huh?
That's not then a cognate between Indo-European and Semitic. Then.
Might be. I don't think it's known to be. But there's other things I mentioned, like wine and star, and especially seven. Those really look like borrowings one way or the other. Seven, you can be sure which way, too. It must have been from Semitic, where the phonology makes a lot of sense. Two, Indo-European, where septem doesn't have any reason to be there. So that's almost certainly from Semitic to Indo-European.
There was an Indo-European word for wine before the borrowing, right?
I don't think so. Wine? It's from yain, Semitic, corresponding to Semitic yain. And the y and the w are very often interchanged there. For example, Arabic walid, son, is yeled in Hebrew. That's very common, this w, y alternation. So yain there and wine in Indo-European, very similar.
In the Indo-European languages, is there a common word for snow?
Yes, I gave it to you. Shingu, he reconstructs it as Shingu, but it gives Snegu.
So that would suggest where the origin would have to be, you know, the origin of the Proto-Indo-European would have to be somewhere, you know, not India, say.
Well, just a place where you don't have very high mountains, because when you have a very high mountain, you have snow, like Iztaccíhuatl in Mexico, white woman. Iztac means snowy or white woman, Iztaccíhuatl.
Very similar to Chinese.
What is this?
So you are saying snow, however, similar, snow itself, it doesn't sound snow in Chinese.
No.
The other form.
I didn't say it was related to Chinese.
Yes, but the other form sounds really similar to Chinese.
Shingu?
Yes. If you're something in Chinese, it would be xue.
Yes, but that's modern. Let me look at the construction. Let me look at the reconstruction. You see, Sergei has gone back to Middle Chinese, and then back to Ancient Chinese, and then back to Proto-Sino-Tibetan.
Well, but no one knows how Ancient Chinese pronounce.
Yes, they do. That's the whole point. Of course they know. They know a lot about it.
Well, every different linguistics give different answers.
Yes, I said that too. But if you look at the cluster of answers, with a certain error, with a certain error, uncertainty, they do know a lot.
For Middle Chinese, they do have this table given in the Tang Dynasty, which they can construct. But for earlier ones, they have to kind of resort to frequency analysis, which isn't really. I mean,
no, they do. Don't worry. Sergei has done beautiful work on this.
I don't believe this.
Well, that's your problem. It's very good work. There's a lot of uncertainty. It's not a matter of certainty. But the probable reconstructions are very well motivated. And they include looking at all the other languages and projecting back to the proto-language of Sino-Tibetan as a whole. And then going forward, the way you can go forward from Common Indo-European, to interpolate between the Common Sino-Tibetan and the Middle Chinese.
But those languages do have this pronunciation in the alphabetic form, which they can trace how the pronunciation changed. But in Chinese,
what alphabetic form? What are you talking about?
I mean, they do have an alphabet which you can read how
it's Tibetan, yeah, but it doesn't go back so very far.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying.
You just don't refuse to understand.
Okay.
You take a whole bunch of languages,
yes,
and you project them back approximately.
Okay.
To a common, you saw how you can do it for Indo-European, for example, how you can do it for Romance, first of all. If Latin didn't exist, you could reconstruct what Latin was from the French, German, for French, Portuguese, Italian, Provençal, and so, Romanian, and so on. You could reconstruct Latin. So in the same way you can reconstruct Proto-Sino-Tibetan, then you can interpolate between that and Middle Chinese, and you begin to get some insight into ancient Chinese.
Okay.
Also, a very interesting thing is that the tones are not there. The tones are modern.
And they have ancient tones.
No, there are no ancient tones.
Well,
there are Middle Chinese.
Middle Chinese
had plenty of tones. Plenty of tones.
Right.
Ancient Chinese didn't have tones.
No.
And earlier,
ancient Chinese, you don't know whether it have tones.
They know. I'm telling you, they know it's an innovation.
Only in Middle Chinese. People begin to classify tones.
But you can do it indirectly. That's
okay.
What I'm trying to say. I just explained.
Okay.
You look at the other languages, and they have tones too, but they're different. Uh-huh. And you trace them back, and you see that the tones disappear, that you can account for all the sound correspondences with no more tones once you go back more than 2,000 years. So the tones are an innovation.
No, but Chinese has more tones than Mandarin.
Yes, of course it does. It has nine. Well, depending on how you count. But you could say it has nine.
But Chinese is older.
Huh?
Chinese is more ancient.
Than what?
Than Mandarin.
Yes, Mandarin is very, very rubbed out. Mandarin you can learn almost nothing from. Mandarin is a very highly evolved
because
modern.
Because northern invaders.
It's a modern language with very highly evolved pronunciation and some of the words. You can't learn much from Mandarin. But ancient Chinese was very conservative and is preserved practically in Cantonese. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of tones, that's true. And in Mandarin, they're less. But these lots of tones came from the following. There were two registers, as you know, high and low.
Right.
And they were corresponded to aspirated and unaspirated consonants, b and p, which are no longer preserved. Instead, you have the tones, the two registers of the tones. But you get rid of the two registers, then you go back to the primordial distinction, which was between voiced and unvoiced.
Right, but the b and p is this confusion between Beijing and Peking. It's the same. The p and the
never mind. In the modern languages, there is no voicing.
Mm-hmm.
Only aspiration and lack of aspiration for unvoiced. P, p, k, p, t, t, and so on. They don't have d. They don't have b. They don't have g. But in ancient Chinese and the earlier part of Middle Chinese, they had this distinction. But in Middle Chinese, the distinction was replaced by the distinction of register in the tones. And that's how the tones got doubled.
I see.
But if you go back still further, there weren't any tones.
How do people know that?
Because you look at the whole set of languages.
Oh.
And you see that the tones are an innovation. And we don't know where they got them from. They probably borrowed them from some neighbors.
What's the fraction of the world's
language? How do you know the other language doesn't have tones?
Is there
in written form that you can infer that whether there's
tones? No, you can look at some modern ones that don't have them.
There are other tonal languages other than Chinese.
Oh, sure, all around the world. Tones are a very common feature. The question is when they came in. Actually, in many parts of the world, it looks as if they're quite recent, which is interesting.
Uh-huh.
It looks as if they may be a phonological innovation in many different parts of the world.
It seems like a very natural thing.
Pardon?
It seems like a very natural thing.
What?
tone.
In music.
So are clicks. Why don't we have clicks everywhere? I mean, what looks natural? What you grew up with looks natural.
Very natural to me.
Well, that's your problem.
You know, Shabbaton, what you said,
yes.
It doesn't come from seven. Shabbat means to stop, to rest.
Nah.
You know, that's what
it comes from Sheva. Seven. Comes from seven.
No, Sheva is seven.
Comes from seven.
Well, but it says it's explicit in the Bible. It said he called me.
I know it's in the Bible. Not everything in the Bible is scientific. I know all about it. It comes from it comes from seven. And it has the mimation at the end. It's typical of early Semitic. And it has the t. It's just fine.
In Arabic, Shabbat is seven.
Sheba is seven.
Sabai in Arabic. Sabai.
Sheba is seven.
Sabai.
Shabbat, it means.
But those are opposite.
No. The secondary meaning. The people who wrote the Bible in 600 BC or 550 BC were not experts on language of thousands of years earlier. They made it up.
Oh, he's back. Okay. David Gross is back, so let's resume.
If anybody wants to talk some more. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
good.
I've got
you
more tea.
Anybody wants to talk some more, I should think you guys would all be worn out, but.
No, but I think there's a lot of it.
So we might need to continue in the Ur language.
That's very difficult.
No, tonight we're going to this Thai restaurant. He's going to order.
What is
Thai.
The? Yeah. What is the?
You are going to order in Thai.
I am not a linguist. My friends are linguists. I'm not a linguist. I'm an amateur. I'm an interested amateur.
How many languages do you speak?
Just English.
The question is, Larry, how many languages do you correct other people in?
Oh, hundreds. Hundreds. Especially their own names. Just read it in my biography. It hasn't ever happened, but what I do is I try to figure out where people's names come from and how they were originally pronounced. And that's quite interesting.
Well, that is interesting.
But I do not, in fact, tell people they ought to pronounce them differently in the modern United States. But that's what people say about me. I don't know what you have to do to get to this stage where they make up stories about you every day that have no truth.
So, should we continue? Or
yeah, if you want. People are asking interesting questions.
Oh, you want to?
I was just wondering, do you think you could relatively date Sanskrit literature by just from pure linguistic?
Yes, roughly. Yes, you could. Yes. The early Rig Veda, we know, is about 1500 BC, 1400, something like that. And you could, in fact, get a crude guess from chronology to give the same answer.
But within the same piece, for instance, the Mahabharata, could you say that this part was written earlier and this part was...
Oh, well, they can do that, but that's not by these methods. Those are the philologists who do that kind of thing, looking very carefully at certain turns of phrase and certain words for things and the absence of other things and so on. Then they create a dating. That's philology. That's really quite a different exercise.
Okay, usually when I have a colloquium, I have trouble getting people to ask questions, but in your case, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So, but why don't we let you finish the talk, and then we can ask.
Well, I finished a lot of it. I wanted to say that the... Well, let me finish the world.
Okay.
I didn't mention Austroasiatic, which includes Mon Khmer, that is Mon in Burma, Khmer is Cambodian language, mm-hmm. Vietnamese without the Chinese borrowings and without the Thai borrowings, mm-hmm. and the Munda languages of southern India. Those all form what's called Austroasiatic. Then there's Austronesian, which includes the languages of Taiwan, Philippines, Indonesia, Micronesia, Melanesia, and Polynesia. That's Austronesian, and that's a very, very tight language family that everybody recognizes and very easy to follow.
You mean the
Taiwanese natives, the indigenous aboriginals of Taiwan, not the Chinese invaders. That's right. And and then there's Thai Kadai, which includes all the Thai languages and the languages of the interior of the island of Hainan. Now, where that fits, we don't know. Benedict proposed putting it with Austronesian, but we're not positive that's correct now. Maybe correct. Then there are the languages of New Guinea and all these islands around here, going all the way up to the Andaman Islands, which are over here. And Joe Greenberg puts those into a thing called Indo-Pacific, which is huge and very old and very poorly studied. And we're trying to get people to put all the data on the web, all the data, and analyze them as much as possible and see if one can't bring some sense out of it. Probably related. Pardon?
Is Tasmanian in that group?
Yes, Tasmanian is in that group. Yes, that's correct. Then there's Australian, and the man who is now taking Sergei's position for a few months, Perus, Ilya Perus, has reconstructed Proto-Australian. He says all the Australian languages, in his opinion, are related, and he's reconstructed Proto-Australian. It's not that old. It's not 42,000 years old, even though the earliest Australians seem to have come there around then. It looks as if the Australian language was brought to Australia much more recently, maybe 10, 15,000 years ago, maybe even less. And but that kind of thing happens in large parts of the world. That what you see in a certain area is not the language of the first people to get there,
sure,
but the language of some people who arrived much later. And probably it's related to Indo-Pacific, to the languages of New Guinea and the other islands down there. Then I spoke about Amerind, which is the supposed language family of all the Americas except the Nadine and the Eskimo Aleut languages. The evidence of archaeology is pretty good for two relatively recent invasions that can be identified with Eskimo Aleut and with Nadine, respectively. And then the other American Indian languages are much older, so that part is good. But whether there was then one previous immigration, maybe 12,000 years ago or 13,000 years ago, that's disputed by archaeologists somewhat. Some people claim there were earlier invasions, and don't know exactly what to say about it. Anyway, what's needed is a huge amount of work to strengthen Joe Greenberg's arguments, or sometimes reject them, depending on how it comes out, about the American languages, so-called Amerind languages. And it's very difficult to do, because whatever anyone says about this, those Americanists will descend and pummel this person to death. And people are actually terrified to work on these problems. I don't think they're really afraid of physical attack, but it comes pretty close. And certainly if you want tenure or anything like that, you can forget it. Poor Perus was fired from his job in Australia for reconstructing Proto-Australian. So,
he didn't have tenure.
Huh? He didn't have tenure.
Do you understand the politics behind it? It's just turf.
Yeah, turf. Well, turf and a conviction that you can't do these things. It's too hard. And that comes from believing it's too hard, so you don't try. And it's true of lots of things in the world. If you don't try, things look hard. The more you don't try, the more they look hard, and so on. Pretty soon you think anyone who's actually doing it is your enemy, especially if it's successful. So it's a bad business. Anyway, I'm glad I found this little bit of money for 5 years of work by this team. And if we don't do anything else, we will at least leave behind a database that can be used for this kind of work forever.
Audio as well as written?
No, it's written, but with explanations. Linguists can describe fairly well how to make sounds. And they really know how to do that, so. But yes, we have some records, we have some recordings, and we're going to try to include those wherever they're available, but that will not be the main tool. The main tool will be things recorded in writing. A lot of it's very primitive, A lot of it is very unskilled anthropologists or even amateurs going out into the field and asking, what are these 100 words in your language? And it's not terribly reliable. But Joe Greenberg pointed out that anything is evidence. As long as you assess its value when you start, you can use anything as evidence. You just have to weight it according to its value.
So you have some indication as to what the language groups were 12,000 years ago?
Yes.
Is there any, were the languages, those Ur languages back then, as sophisticated as modern languages?
Yes. Yes, seems that way.
So you could do modern physics, for example, with those languages.
I don't see why not.
Or even literature.
I don't know why not. I don't know why not. They were complex.
That extends back 40,000 years?
Probably, because if we look at today's so-called primitive people, traditional people, their languages are very complex. I was explaining before, I think you weren't here, that racists had this point of view. For example, a lot of modern immigrants from Europe to Australia, from Britain to Australia especially, imagined that the Australian Aboriginal languages must have only 10 words and one grammatical rule and so on, but they're just as complex as Latin or Greek or Sanskrit or whatever. And
so you're having slight problems with dating.
Oh yes, the dating is approximate.
4,000, which is what two more stages would be, even compared to 40,000, and not 60,000.
There's that problem. Yes.
Languages went through stages of complexity.
That is possible. But then, where were the homelands for the newly? We have this problem.
Well, they could have been the same in Africa, with different stages of development of the language.
Maybe, but you see, if you have words in common, then we want to know where was the proto-language. So it's a little, as long as there's a discrepancy in date, there is some problem.
But isn't it unlikely that language with the complexity that it has, yeah, they would have been developed that rapidly?
People differ in their opinions. I would have guessed it was developed pretty rapidly once the physiological equipment was there. Maybe there was a mutation that helped to make it possible, physically or mentally. And I would guess that it came relatively quickly. But what's relatively quickly? I mean, a few thousand years or a few hundred or a few decades or what? We have a very interesting example. You know that there are gesture languages like American Sign Language, which American deaf children learn in great numbers. And many of them prize it very much. And it's not the alphabet language where you form the letters and so on. It's got nothing to do with letters. It's got really nothing to do with English. It's a sign language, where the elements of the language are gestures. Now that should be studied more from the point of view of communication, because the communication is quite sophisticated in that language. It's not totally primitive at all. Now some children in Nicaragua apparently in two generations developed a fully developed sign language of their own.
Without knowing a different
They were deaf and mute. And
never.
Yeah. Very interesting. It took 50 years or something. I mean, it's kind of amazing. So it might have been very rapid, actually. We just don't know what happened. There's no way to know. What we'd like to do is to trace the relationship among migrations, genes, physical culture, physical anthropology, and so on, and see if one can construct something. And it's not so bad chronologically now as it used to be, much less bad. But still, there's this gap between something like 40,000 and something like 20,000, and we don't know exactly how that works. But that's a much less serious gap than there used to be. So maybe there's some chance. Now, what happens is, when you look at the lists for these 10, 12, 9, whatever they are, big superfamilies, you find that there are a lot of words that are pretty much in common around the world. The word for bone, like coch, in Latin, costa, which is a rib. You have to allow some semantic shift here, because these are very, very old. But you find lots of things that are, there's this word for uncle, for maternal uncle, caca, which is just all over the world. And there are enough of these things that they interfere with the classification into superfamilies. That's quite remarkable. You make a list of things that you think show that the superfamily is special and really includes the parts that you claim it includes, and then you discover that some of those words are actually found pretty much all over the world. So it's kind of bizarre. And what it means is that there is some anecdotal support for the notion of monogenesis, or something very close to monogenesis. But it's not a scientific proof by any means. And then this idea that certain other features, including some grammatical features, might be traceable through a finite number, relatively small number of steps from an original form. That's an interesting idea, which I think has some anecdotal support too. So we believe that word order and maybe ergativity and things like that went that way. We could reconstruct the original and look at the changes in terms of one or two waves of change, not an infinite or very large number of reverberations that would create equilibrium. The same with sound changes, phonological changes, which have an arrow of time, with, as I said, P often going to F, maybe going to H, maybe going to nothing, but you don't often see H going to P. And you see glottal stops detached from their attached consonants, and you don't usually see them reattached.
Is there any theory, given that some of these shift, or you know, go both ways.
Yes.
Is there any theory as to why shifts occur at all? What is the
not a very good one. Why, for example, in English, in Germanic, why in Germanic do we change the P's to F's, the D's to T's, and the K's to H's? Now, those are all the same thing, basically. See, they're all parallel. In each case, you soften.
You think.
Why do you do that?
You think, well, I mean,
what was it about the Germanic ancestors that made them want to change K to H and then H, change P to F, change D to T? Well, what distinguishes one? What you'd have to do is to formulate it this way. What distinguishes one people from another? That the first people wants to do this, and the other one doesn't. Now, of course, it could be their neighbors. Could be they have neighbors who have a different sound pattern, and they try to imitate the neighbors. But then, where did the neighbors get it? So it's a little tricky.
The opposite is a human tendency. Sometimes you want to set yourself apart.
Also that, yes. When the tribe splits, there may be some tendencies to enhance the division. We saw how our Bulgarian friend, Pietkov, was asking about Bulgarian and Macedonian. I don't know, most of you missed the exchange. I didn't realize he was Bulgarian. He was just testing me. He wasn't asking for information. He was just trying to see if I knew anything. Fortunately, I passed the test. But he asked about Bulgarian and Macedonian. Well, they're mutually comprehensible. You can regard Macedonian as a dialect of Bulgarian, which is what the Bulgarian government thinks. But the Macedonian government thinks Macedonian is a separate Slavic language, and they try to make it as separate as they can in the schools and so on. But still, they can't help Macedonians and Bulgarians from understanding each other, which they do. So, but they try to do it. Nowadays, Serbo-Croat has split for political reasons. And in Croatia, they try to teach a different... They've always used different alphabets, because the Croatians were evangelized by the Catholic Church, and the Serbians were evangelized by the Orthodox Church. So they use the Cyrillic letters, and the Croats use the Latin letters. But the languages were basically the same. But now they're trying to make them different by introducing special words and so on. So there are these fissiparous tendencies.
You're talking about softening the continents. Has anybody given any thought to the fact that people might have wanted to appear less aggressive and a softer sound?
Could be, yes, but then why these people and not those? Why did the Germanic people want to feel so unaggressive? I mean, what was it about Germanic people? Pardon? We know a lot about when, although not exactly, but we have a lot of limits on when. Yeah, from the reconstructions and lots of other things. Pardon?
For example, this change of P's into F's, when didn't happen?
The P's into F's and T's and D's into T's and T's into TH's and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think in the first millennium BC, most likely, approximately.
Are you limited right now more by the data or the analysis techniques?
We're limited by everything. We're limited by data. We're limited by the inadequacy of data even when there are data. We're limited by the techniques, especially the chronological techniques and the reconstructions and so on, although people are doing remarkably well. We're limited by the hostility of the main establishment, especially in this country. Except maybe in Africa, where, as I say, they lost the battle and they have never taken up arms again for some reason. But in the rest of the world, exactly the same statement, exactly the same kind of statement is rejected. There are many, many things. Also, there are disagreements among our people. They still don't know a lot and they argue a great deal. And even though they have methods that are approximately valid, there's still a huge amount to argue about. So it's very slow, but I'm so delighted to be able to help a little bit. I've always wanted to do that. And you know that in the 18th century, before Indo-European, Uralic was established. And this was done later on through the work of Castrén, but the very early work was done at the instigation of Leibniz, who sent people out to collect data on the Volga and so on the Uralic languages. Yes?
The conservative, the sort of traditional
yes.
Conservative linguists, do they reject the Nostratic theory as well?
Yes. Yes, they do. Nostratic means several things, and that doesn't help the cause any, the fact that there are these different things. Sometimes it means what this one guy still wants to cling to, namely that you include Afro-Asiatic.
Right, so let's just say
sometimes it's without, usually it's without Afro-Asiatic. Then sometimes they want to put in Dravidian and Cardelian as well. Eurasiatic doesn't include those.
So let's say Eurasiatic.
Okay, yes. Yes, yes, they do, yes. Yes. And the African equivalents that they accept are just the same. just they lost that battle and they haven't lost this one yet. But as I say, the worst of the Americanists, they are just really furious. And I don't say they're wrong. I mean, maybe Joe's Amarin should actually be broken up into six parts or something. But the likelihood that it's broken up into 300 parts, which is what they want, is insane. I mean, there is no such likelihood. It's zero. But everyone wants his own little backyard to be an independent kingdom.
How quickly does the signal to noise, or want to say, it degrade as you go back in time?
Oh, it degrades all right. I mean, they're right about that. If you look at the 12,000-year-old families, super families, they're obviously less rigorous. The work is less rigorous than for the 6,000. But it's amazing how well you can do with the same methods, the traditional comparative methods. Joe did it all in his head, and of course he weakened his case that way. Even though he was usually right, I think. But these guys try to do it with the reconstructions and the sound system and everything. And it comes out pretty good.
Do you think we'll ever be able to go back all the way to 40,000 years?
I think we will. My personal guess, this is not scientific at all, but my personal guess is that yes, we will be able to reconstruct some words, some grammatical rules, of the original proto-language, if there is such a thing. And my personal guess is that there probably is such a thing. But these are guesses, and based on anecdotal evidence, it's not scientific. But the other work is pretty scientific. It's pretty good. And I just hope that we can find some more funding to keep this going, so it's not just a 4 or 5 year project. But the most exciting part is meeting with all the other people, the geneticists and the archaeologists and the dentists and so on, and putting together all these different things. And of course, as I said, they don't fit exactly, but there are some similarities, and those similarities are very interesting. Any other questions or remarks? Yes?
So I read somewhere that they have a new language, just like Neo-Malaysian, which are what they call Creole languages, which are created in the colonies.
Slightly Creolized,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So there's a claim that they all have the same kind of grammar structure, which is kind of supportive to the universal grammar idea.
Maybe. Bickerton, Derek Bickerton is a Chomskyan. Derek Bickerton is a Chomskyan. Who likes to look at these fascinating pidgin and Creole languages.
Right.
And it's certainly true that when you get Creolized, when you're no longer a trade jargon or a pidgin, and you become a Creole, you become a regular language. It means that you're the first language of some children in one or two or three generations. And then you have a language that's a regular full-fledged language. And English is somewhat Creolized, the result of the Norman conquest. Romance is somewhat Creolized as a result of the barbarian conquest of the Western Roman Empire, and so on and so on. So you have degrees of Creolization, if you like. But they don't change the fact that you get a real language. So this is encouraging to Chomskyans because it says that once it goes through the children, and it goes through what they consider to be this hardwired equipment in the children, you get always a regular modern language. Even though it's maybe very heavily Creolized, it still has the kind of complexity, the order of magnitude of complexity of a regular modern language. But I don't know whether Chomsky was right about the children having an inadequacy of data, because he didn't pay too much attention to the world. See, children also see the world. They not only get a lot of instruction from parents and siblings and so on about how to speak the language properly, they also they also see the world, and the language is adapted somewhat to the world. So, well, they see the world around them. They observe physical phenomena and all sorts of other things, and some of the structure of the language has to do with that. For example, the passage of time. So you have different markers for the future and the past, that sort of thing. So maybe that Noam didn't include that enough and so on. But I'm perfectly willing to grant that he may be right. I'm not opposed to his proposition. What he's done with it is very disappointing, because he hasn't really pointed out what are the hardwired rules and what are the parameters.
Well, it's not even.
He just keeps writing about it over and over with different names.
But you could also imagine that there's even more hardwired. So you go back to some of the primitive. You talked about, for example, certain sounds that are likely to be the sounds that a baby makes.
Baby makes all sounds. Well, the sounds of all human languages are made by little babies. Then they drop the ones that are not encouraged by the that are not similar to the ones the caregivers use.
Like mom, mom, mom.
They make all the sounds, all the clicks. If you listen carefully, you'll hear everything. The whole sound treasury of the human race is made by little babies. Everything. Then they drop the ones that are not used by the caregivers. Well, sometimes not, and that those are linguists. But oh yeah, sure. Well, it's easy to make glottal sounds. Everybody makes glottal sounds. I mean, Cockneys and Scots people and so on. That's great. Ball. A ball. You hear that in London. You hear it in Scotland. Scotland. A Scottish way of talking. Yes?
Has there been any effort to quantify the complexity of language and observe it perfectly?
Yes, there is some. I'm not too, even though I'm supposed to be a student of complexity, I'm not too familiar with that literature, but there is some literature on that. Phonological complexity is interesting. It doesn't go very far, but it's interesting. There's another proposition that we have in our search for arrows of time. Merritt Rulin and I looked a lot at arrows of time in linguistic change. And I mentioned five or six different ones. But one of them has to do with the phonological inventory, what sounds are available for the language, in particular what phonemes, that is to say sounds including sound distinctions. And you find that when people invade a new area where there have never been people, it looks as if they progress outward they lose phonological complexity. In the Pacific you can see this beautifully in Austronesian, where by the time you get to Hawaii there's a very little phonological complexity, although there are short vowels and long vowels which many people ignore. And of course the glottal stop, which replaces the K in Polynesian. In Tahitian, the glottal stop replaces the K and the ng sound, but in Hawaiian it only replaces the K.
Is there some
You can see it also in South America, where it seems that people spread out, Amerinds, if you want to call them that, spread out in South America some many thousands of years ago, starting about 12,000 years ago.
So is there a plausible explanation?
Well, it's as if there's a certain natural tendency when you move apart and you're no longer subject to the influence of your fellows, you dilute.
But you could also diversify and become richer.
You could, but that doesn't seem to be what happens. So that makes it non-trivial, right? I mean, since you can imagine the opposite, it is a non-trivial proposition.
Now, when one people conquer another people,
oh, when people conquer at other people, usually one or the other language predominates with only loan words from the other one. It's not always the conquerors. Sometimes it's the conquered people.
What's an example?
Chinese?
Yeah.
Yeah, Chinese. When the Mongols conquered China, for example, there were, of course, very few Mongols and lots of Chinese. So.
That's a run of business.
Well, all right. China was always the most densely populated part of the world for many, many centuries anyway. Yes?
I'm just bringing a perspective to you because I was deaf all my life and I wasn't diagnosed. And so to audiologists and everyone, they are surprised that I can speak so well. They don't understand all the people with my kind of hearing loss do not have this kind of expression or voice ability to, you know, speak the language. And I find when I'm with other language people, I will immediately start speaking like them, taking on all the characteristics of their talk. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a family of entertainers. So because I wasn't hearing, but I was mimicking the feeling of the sound. I felt the rhythm, I felt the pattern of the sounds, and I started just unconsciously to mimic what I was seeing in the, you know, the lips.
It must have been visual cues must have been very important.
Yeah, well, you use everything, but you have Paula Todal on your staff there at the Institute, who found a different way that the brain is learning.
So I've interacted with her a lot. She's very interesting. Paula Talal.
She's going to find out the same thing about the way we understand language, the way we hear sound eventually, as they get to know the brain better, neurology, that, you know, it's maybe not as we think it is. You know, you're saying how people get languages, but I think as they went into other territories,
yes,
that they took it on through their, you know, feeling of the language, through...
Yeah, but I'm sure that's true, but I don't think that affects this particular question we were just talking about, namely what happens when people invade an empty area with no people, why the phonological complexity seems to get reduced. No, it's very interesting what you say, and Paula Talal's work is wonderful. She's not a resident member of the Institute, but she comes every few weeks, and we love to see her. There's also something very interesting about the ancient Iberians, which I like to discuss in connection with her. She looked into linguistic disability in children, and she associated it with the difficulty of processing certain sounds rapidly enough, particularly the plosive consonants, p, k, t, d, b, g, d, so on. These plosive consonants go quickly, and she found that the little children with this linguistic disability couldn't process those sounds fast enough. And so she invented a modified form of the language, English in this case, in which those consonants are emphasized and prolonged as much as possible, which is very hard to do. K, to prolong k is hard, but you do it as much as possible and you make it very loud. And then these children can hear it and reproduce it and so on, and then gradually they can go over to deal with regular English. So she's cured this particular form of linguistic disability. Yeah, computers all over the place, but that's the basic idea. Now, my children, I noticed when they were little, and I'm sure it's true of very, very many children, had trouble spelling out words with plosives. So log was fine, no problem. U-log. But fog was fine, fog. But cat was a big problem for the little teeny tiny children, of course. I'm not saying my teenagers had trouble with cat and dog, but the little tiny children, k, at, they couldn't hear that was cat because of the k, k, at is not cat, it's cat. And the cat in the hat. So anyway, they had this trouble, which it seems like a sort of universalized version of this linguistic disability, that all children have a little bit of it in a sense, because these things process quickly, and it's hard to think of them as separate elements, therefore, whereas when you can prolong something, as in so-called continuance, then it's easy to think of it as part of the written thing. Then I discovered that the ancient Iberians, whose language we don't understand, but whose writing we can read, turn into sounds, they used single letters except for syllables beginning with the plosives, in which case they had syllable signs. So they had ko, ki, ka, and so on with syllable signs, and po, pi, pa with syllable signs. But ul was a single letter, and ur was a single letter, and o, ah, e, and so on by themselves were single letters. Very interesting. It's as if they had encountered this problem with children and decided to resolve it by using a syllable, whenever there was a plosive followed by a vowel.
In describing this problem with children, I was reminded of the fact that I use a voice software to talk to my computer. That's just presumably, I noticed that certain words, certain sounds it has a lot of trouble with.
Uh-huh.
Presumably that's just a programming error, right?
Well, what do you have in a computer other than a programming error? You think your machine's broken?
Right, so it's just a programming
error. Must be a programming error, yeah.
But certain sounds
stupid
it seems
computer.
To have trouble.
Stupid computer, yeah, yes.
But certain sounds they do, right?
Yeah. Anyway, any questions? Any other ideas or questions?
You talked about chronological complexity.
Yes.
What about the more obvious issue of extent of vocabulary? How does that evolve?
Well, it's very hard to study the full extent of vocabulary in very ancient reconstructed languages, because all we can do is reconstruct from the stuff we have. But you find that often there are words for things that are pretty close together. In fact, sometimes you can't tell the meanings apart, and yet both words are there. So that gives the impression that there must have been quite a lot of lexical richness, since you have this sometimes this confusion between words with almost the same meaning. There must have been quite a lot of complexity as far back as you can trace it. But so far, the real tracing has been done only to the superfamilies. The superfamilies is still just something we talk about. And the monogenesis, of course, is you know, something you just see with this anecdotal evidence that I described. But the whole process is so fascinating. It's just marvelous. And these people are so wonderful, these people who do this work. They're immensely learned and very bright, and very eager to change their ideas to suit the evidence and so on. They're real scientists. But the people who attack them don't behave so much like real scientists, even though they are often even more learned. But they have very rigid ways of thinking.
Is there any possibility of making predictions from this field?
Well, like what?
I don't know.
Well, proto-languages are predictions.
No, but they're constructed.
You see, you can predict that when you study more Sino-Tibetan languages, tribal languages, which are obscure now, not really properly connected, collected, that they'll fall into the pattern. And that's a prediction. And if it's not verified, then you have to complicate the theory in the description. So yes, I would say that almost everything they do is a prediction.
What is the estimated number of Sino-Tibetan?
Oh, they've got a lot of them now. And the Chinese scholars have pretty much...
hundreds or tens? Thousands?
No, not thousands. Maybe a hundred.
Hundreds.
No, maybe a hundred or something like that. Sino-Tibetan. I don't know. I was just talking to Perus about it. He's a great expert, and I forget what number. He gave me a number, and I can't remember the number now.
Because but you told me that Chinese and...
Chinese and Tibetan and Burmese are the famous ones, but there are lots of little...
Chinese and Cantonese should really be regarded separately.
Oh, well, that's also true, yes. I might make that remark to everybody. The Chinese so-called dialects are dialects in a special sense, namely that they are written with the same Chinese characters. But they represent very different sounds, and if you look very closely, you find that in some of these so-called dialects, even the word order is different, and you should really have little arrows to read properly. And so that it's by artificial means that these have become a language. In fact, anywhere else, if they didn't use Chinese characters, you wouldn't call these dialects. You would call them separate languages, because they're quite different. But they're tied together politically, and they're tied together by the writing system, so that they're regarded instead as dialects.
Wouldn't you think that a once written language was invented? That slowed the whole process?
Yes, I maintain in arguing with Starostin that his slowing down of linguistic change in the last few thousand years is possibly connected with writing, because most of his evidence has to come from places where there was writing, or he wouldn't have the evidence.
That is a retarding effect.
And it certainly should be a retarding effect. He says that it doesn't look quite that way when you look in detail. We have to thrash it out some more. I would guess that you're right about that, but he has some arguments on the other side which I haven't yet fully understood. He's a very smart man, so I wouldn't be quick to say he's wrong about anything.
Now, since writing was just brought up,
Are there good theories on the origin because of the alphabetic languages?
Oh, yes. Alphabet is. Most people, including great experts on the alphabet, have said very strange things about the alphabet. It's very odd. The alphabet was invented once. And it was invented by Semitic people for writing some, no, not the Phoenicians. I know, that's what they say. It was not the Phoenicians, it was earlier. It was invented by Semitic people for writing Semitic language, and then it was copied. Now, it was copied in two different ways. In some places it was copied by the letters, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, and so on and so on. Some places it was copied by another kind of alphabet, but they had heard of the alphabet, and they made up an alphabet for their own languages. No, alphabet. Now, the hieroglyphics were also an alphabet earlier, but of a different kind. They were supplemented by whole word signs and syllable signs and determinatives, so that ancient Egyptian was a big mess, the writing was a big mess. And when you saw a symbol, it could stand for a word, or the first letter of the word, or the first syllable of the word, or a determinative sign that told you what kind of thing you were going to see in the next signs. So the invention of the alphabet was a purification process. They lopped off all this other garbage. They said, all we need is the alphabetic sign. We don't need the rest of it. Right. But that was not probably done by the Egyptians themselves. It was done in an area, maybe of Egypt, or just adjacent to Egypt, in the Sinai Desert or somewhere. It was done by Semitic-speaking people who then took pictographs, 20-something pictographs, and they gave names to them because they were pictures. Picture of an ox skull, picture of a house, picture of a camel, picture of all these things, and then a picture of an eye, and then they named them after the first letters of these objects, A, B, C, and so on, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, and so on. So this was done, now they used to think, Sir Alan Gardner had a very good proposal, that this was done in the Sinai Desert in Wadi Firan, where you can see the so-called proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. I've seen them there in Wadi Firan. Justinian sent a tribe of Dacians from Romania to guard that area for the empire and to guard St. Catherine's Monastery nearby. And they're still there. They become Arabs. They live in Wadi Firan. Very interesting story. And they sort of guard these early pictures. But it's alphabetic writing. It says, for example, Liba'alat to the lady. Baal, of course, is master or husband, and Baalat is lady, and L is to in Semitic languages. So Le Baalat is to the lady. And then there's some others which they can't read quite so well. But now they've discovered the same phenomenon in Egypt itself, nearby. And they don't know exactly when and where, but it looks as if Semites at the edge of Egypt took the Egyptian notion and stripped away from the picture writing the syllable, the whole word, and the determinative, leaving only the first letter idea, the acrophonic principle, and did it for Semitic. And they used different pictures, sometimes the same pictures, but for different letters, different words meaning the same thing. So, for example, this jagged line means water, okay? And in Hebrew, the water is mem, maim, whatever, some word like that. In Semitic. And in Hebrew, ma'im in modern Hebrew or biblical Hebrew, and mem is the letter. In Arabic, mim is the letter. But in Egypt, they had a similar word because it's an Afro-Asiatic language, but they didn't use it so much. The word they used more was ne for water. So this thing stands for N in Egyptian instead of M. They used a different word for water. And they used the, insofar as this stood for a single sound, it stood for n, but in both cases, water. So they took over the Egyptian pictures, used them for Semitic words, and the first letter of the Semitic word was the letter represented, and the name was the whole object that was pictured in the Egyptian hieroglyphic, which they copied. So they copied the thing for house, and they got Beit, B, and so on and so forth.
But before a language is deciphered, for example, this language of Mondragon,
yes,
can people tell whether it's alphabetic or...
Yes, yes, by the number of signs, by the number of signs, typically, yes. If it has 25 signs, it's probably an alphabet. If it has 80, 90 sounds, it's probably a syllabary. It has several hundred, it probably includes hieroglyphic behavior and so on. Yes, and that one, they're not so sure with Mohenjo-Daro, but they've tried to interpret it by having the pictures stand for syllables, and the syllables associated with words describing the objects, because you can see what the pictures are of quite a lot. And then they try to identify it with Dravidian, but it's all very speculative. Hasn't worked out so well. Yes?
So Korean,
they say, was an alphabet made up by their great king so-and-so, who decided they ought to have an alphabet. But of course, alphabets had been invented in the world before, and he must have heard about them. But he invented an alphabet for Korean. Now, if you look at the letters, they look rather as if they came from little bits of Chinese characters. But the Koreans hotly deny that. They say this king had an elaborate phonological theory, and he made up the Korean letters to agree with that phonological theory. Pardon? No. Only the idea was copied, not the Semitic alphabet in this case. In some cases, they copied the Semitic alphabet. We use the Semitic alphabet in a form that's gone through the Romans, the Greeks and the Romans. But the Phoenicians, the Greeks and the Romans. But they just use the idea of the alphabet.
It's a two-dimensional alphabet, not a one-dimensional.
No, it's a regular alphabet, but they group the letters into clusters for the words. So the word is a cluster of Korean letters, and there's another word that's another cluster of Korean letters, and so they don't just write the letters out the way we do.
Is a syllabary a separate idea, or is it...
Syllabary is a separate idea, but in many cases, as with ancient Egyptian, when writing was invented, they sometimes had a mishmash of different things. That is, a symbol could stand for a whole word, of which it pictured, or a syllable, or the initial letter, or a determinative. And the simplification was the invention. It's like Charles Lamb's dissertation on roast pig. Have you read that?
No.
No. He tells about a Chinese story of a Chinese boy, teenage boy, who was left in charge of the farm by his parents. And for some reason, they had pigs. I don't know what they did with the pigs, but they had pigs. And they kept the pigs in a barn. And the kid was doing something, I don't know, he was smoking in the barn or something. He burned down the barn by accident as his parents were away. And he was just terrified of being badly beaten when they came back. They found the barn burned. But in the meantime, he had touched a dead pig. And he burned his finger, and so he put his finger in his mouth. And that was the first time a human being had tasted roast pig. And so when his parents came home, besides saying he was sorry and so on, he also showed his father how to burn his finger on a piece of dead pig and then stick the finger in the mouth, and the father did it. "Wow," said the father. And he went out and told all the neighbors about this brilliant son and how he had burned down the barn and made this marvelous new food that nobody had ever tasted before. All the neighbors started burning down their barns. And then later on, they discovered you didn't have to burn down the whole barn. You could just burn the pig. That's the same with the alphabet. They discovered you didn't need all this garbage with the hieroglyphics and the syllabary and the determinatives. You just could use the alphabetical part of the system. That story of Charles Lamb is so important for culture. I mean, think in theoretical physics how many times we've had to do that. And some elaborate junk, and we could throw away 95% of it, and it wouldn't do any harm. In fact, it would make the whole thing clearer.
Okay, well, should we...
Thank you very much. I thought you were more
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
This is mine.